Welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 43. And this evening we're discussing the week that was May the 10th through the 16th, 1990. And I'm joined this week, of course, I'm your host, Chris Zelna, of course. And I'm joined this week by my co-host, the man who, again, has proven again that he writes for just about every news site around. News, opinion, whatever. I know you already work for him, but it's, again, you just reinforce it with your latest article, which we'll talk about later in the show. But David Bixenspan, Bix, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I was so excited when you were going to mention me first, and then no, you had to correct yourself.
Yeah, I can't remember. I can't forget to mention my name. So, but yeah,
you do it so often.
I know. Now, it's interesting that the column you had this week regarding wrestling hotlines. Let's go ahead and talk about that real quick while we can.
Yes, it's part of Colonel Magazine at Daily Dot.
Yeah, Daily Dot, Colonel Magazine. You wrote an article about the rise and fall of wrestling hotlines. How'd that go?
Good. It was originally going to be for the WrestleMania issue. There were some delays with the editing and stuff, so it got moved to this one, which was first and last was the theme of the issue. And because one of the things in there was about Dominic Valenti's wrestling hot seat, it kind of has the last of the hotlines, so they moved it to this week, and that's there now at colonelmag.daily.com. And got comments from Jim Cornette, Steve Beverly, Lance Russell, and Dominic Valenti, of course, and some fun stuff in there. I had a good time writing that, and something I've wanted to do something on for a while in some form, so I'm glad I got to do it.
Yes, pretty good stuff, so everybody go check it out.
And of course, Cornette's quote steals the show, though.
Yeah, it's pretty good. We are guestless this evening. I know that I had kind of teased at a big guest appearing on our show tonight, but unforeseeable things happened, and that way it goes, and it's just me and Bix riding solo again, so I think we'll do a pretty good job here. But first off, before you can get to the show, seen a lot of positive feedback lately on last week's show and all the other shows in general. And I know I don't do this enough on this show, but I'd like to send a big thank you to everybody that listens to this show and Exile on Bad Street. Anytime we get the positive feedback, it's always welcome. If I don't reply to you directly or, whatever, definitely enjoy bringing content for you to listen to that not a lot of the people talk about and stuff like that. So absolutely thank you for everything, and keep on listening. Tell everybody else that you know to listen. Let's get more listeners. Let's make this thing grow even more. All right. Start the show with the National Wrestling Alliance, and man, there's some big news going this week. Ole Anderson was introduced to the wrestlers as the new head booker at the TV tapings on May 14th in Indianapolis, Indiana. Definitely deserved that one. And whatever new direction will come now will probably become evident at the Capital Combat pay-per-view on May 19th in the TV that airs the first weekend in June. Anderson was announced as the sole booker, and that management wouldn't do anything to interfere in the direction that he wanted to take the promotion. Ole brought in Bob Roop and Ron West to be his road managers, and Wahoo McDaniel was fired as a road agent.
Now, wait a second. The booker in WCW was in charge of hiring the road agents?
I guess this time he was. He brought in his crew. Yeah.
Which is interesting, because the WCW, it's not like they gave bookers the kind of autonomy usually that like some promotions had as far as hiring and firing. I mean, he was able to bring people in, but it's not like he had that you would think of him as having that degree of say.
This is a message I guess they were sending at this time period that would change. But Ole is also planning on taking Woman off of television and still plans to do color on Worldwide Wrestling with Tony Schiavone, although he did a terrible job according to Dave. Now, the main fears, though, about Ole taking over is that the NWA in the last year has been all about pushing younger talent. But now, with Ole in charge, everyone is scared that more older guys would get pushed and younger guys will get phased out. One insider told Steve Beverly that nobody really wanted to take the job. And why would they? Because it's not the most secure place to work. Now, Jack Petrick, the head muckety-muck of Turner, of WCW.
Well, the head muckety-muck of WCW interfacing with Turner. He was the president, right?
Yes. He had a different point of view regarding that statement and told Beverly that their TV ratings were good. Ad revenue for TV was doing well. Plus, they have a good roster. They just had to get their house shows moving in a better direction, but they had done at the Meadowlands. Petrick was also asked about the money Turner has lost since owning the NWA, with an estimated $1 million a month, which Petrick deemed outrageous, but they have had definitive losses because of the poor houses. All right, now, before we move on to other stuff regarding this, the fears of talent about Ole and who he was going to push and who he wasn't going to push, that pretty much came to high fruition.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think you could argue it turned out worse than anyone expected, because yes, he was bringing in older guys that he shouldn't have brought in, and then he was also the guy that was started bringing in all these green guys that he shouldn't have brought in either because they were cheap.
Yes. And the, I mean, the sign was there when the first guy Ole brought in was Junkyard Dog. And then Paul Orndorff comes in. Kerry Von Erich was supposed to come in. So
Orndorff was a good idea, I feel like.
Yeah.
Even if it didn't really work out.
But you look at what the NWA was, you know, before this, where they were pushing a younger group of guys. Okay. More often than not. And now that's about to change.
I think they only brought in Orndorff. Then it, you know what I mean? It's like if you bring in Orndorff with a group of older guys, it's one thing. If you bring in Orndorff, it's another.
And one of the big, you know, casualties of this was Brian Pillman. Brian Pillman,
as happened every time they changed bookers.
Yeah, Brian Pillman's push crashed and burned quickly. And some other casualties as well, but
I mean, him and Zank lost the U.S. tag titles at the next pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And Zank Combat, they lost to Midnight Express.
Yeah, and Tom Zank was very vocal about Ole Anderson on his appearances on the Wrestling Observer Live show, including that famous one about Sting, which what was it again, Vic? They said about Sting? What Ole said about Sting?
I wonder if the audio's online. He makes $750,000 a year, and that he would suck cock, in his words, for $750,000 a year. Line him up.
He sucked cock all day long for what Sting was paid. Line him up. Okay. Yeah. All right, here we go. All right. Let's see. Tom to Ole. All right, here's what Tom. Why are you breaking my balls? What about a guy like Sting? He's making $750,000 a year. Why don't you go up to him? All the people are dressed like chairs. That's what Tom said. Ole says to me, $750,000 a year? For $750,000 a year, I'd suck cock all day. Line them up. And Tom Zink said, and Ole, if you're listening, you'd sue me for slander if that's a lie, because that's the damn truth. What do you say to that? What do you say to a guy that says something like that? He went after me and Pillman, but not a guy like Sting who wasn't drawing, making $750,000 a year. But Ole said, line him up. He'd suck cock all day for $750,000. A great moment in history of Wrestling Observer Live. But
yeah, but Tom Zank has bigger things to worry about than defamation lawsuits.
Yeah. But, all right, let's move on to Jack Petrick. The statements he was making about the TV ratings, ad revenue. House shows was a huge failure.
They were doing good TV ratings at this time, though.
Yeah.
The TV ratings had completely recovered.
But house show was a huge failure. And the Meadowlands was, again, like one of the rare places that was drawing.
How well were they drawing in Meadowlands, though? Like, I'm sure Baltimore was still drawing, but how well was the Meadowlands doing?
So I'll find a.
I'll go look at the.
I'm looking right now. I'm looking right now. Okay. Well, they had their first show was on April 26th.
Okay.
And there's no paid number. There's no number. But you look at after the fact, they were drawing a less than what WWF was drawing. And then it got really bad in the next year, but they were drawing about 1,500, 2,000 less, about 8,000, 7,000. It's funny that he makes that statement.
By WCW standards, though.
But it's funny he makes that statement, though, because that Meadowlands show was the first show they had run there in 2 years. So he's using a sample size of one show.
Do you mean they hadn't run the Meadowlands? You mean the New York market?
The New York market, excuse me. Yeah. So he's using that one show to justify his point. Okay. I mean, you can't do that. You need a larger sample size than that. But anyway, back to the announcement.
It's wrestling. What do you expect?
I know it. The announcement came as a mild surprise because he wasn't prominently mentioned on the list of candidates. Cowboy Bill Watts was always considered the frontrunner for a position, even as late as May 13th. But Watts always insisted to have more power than the promotion was willing to give him. Watts didn't want to answer to Jim Herd and only wanted to answer to Jack Petrick, which was power the company wasn't willing to give to their head booker, not to mention there were differences on money also. Watts felt like that Herd should run the business end of things while he ran the wrestling end of things, making them equals. There were thoughts that Watts was having second thoughts about the job and was going to come in. But that was squelched on May 9th when Ole was officially made the booker. The funny thing about Watts was that he was shown a list of people the promotion wanted fired, and Ole was on that list. And it's funny how Ole was officially made the booker on May 9th, but Bill Watts was still in the hunt as on May 13th.
So, Bill Watts ever not in the hunt to run WCW?
I know, that's the running theme of this show, but
it's the Bam Bam Bigelow of executive positions.
Yeah, the thing is about Ole being on that list of people they wanted fired. That's pretty funny. I mean,
he was the Cameron of 1990. I guess nowhere would that make him the Adam Rose in 1990. I don't know. I may have screwed up the analogy.
No, I think you were right. Or maybe he was a Summer Rae in 1990. But I think the deal was that he was a guy who wasn't really – he didn't want to wrestle anymore, of course, because he's old. And they didn't want him wrestling anymore.
Well, and he got hurt too.
And he got hurt. And they just didn't see any really value of having him around. And then they make him head booker. WCW, everybody!
The answer is always WCW.
But thing is, all right, let's say Bill Watts takes this job. How different is 1990 WCW with Bill Watts under control? And how long does Bill Watts have this job before they get rid of it?
Well, would he technically be the booker or would he be more? Because... seems like they were willing to give him it seems like the title they were willing to give him was more than Booker.
He wanted to be in charge of wrestling. He didn't want to be in charge of the business part. So he just wanted to be the guy in front of creative. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. But he didn't want to answer to Jim Herd.
I don't think he lasts either way. I think it ends fairly quickly either way, but I don't think it necessarily ends the same way that his eventual run did.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I it may be pretty safe to say, but I think that a lot of things would have been different as far as who gets pushed. The theory was behind this was that Watts, if he got the job, Eddie Gilbert was going to probably be like maybe the assistant, the top assistant booker. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting to look at it. But even more interesting is the list of candidates besides Watts and Ole. Listen to this group of names.
I haven't looked at this yet, so should I take a guess?
No, be surprised. All right,
Scott.
The list of The list of candidates was an interesting one, as you had such names speculated as Lynn Denton, J.J. Dillon, Bill Dundee, Dusty Rhodes, Vern Gagne, Greg Gagne, Jerry Lawler, Roddy Piper, and Jerry Jarrett, who did meet with Jim Herd a couple of days before the early decision was made. And there was a meeting scheduled with Vern Gagne on May 15th, Greg Gagne on May 15th, but that was canceled, of course. Dusty's name being on this list was interesting, especially because once the Booker job came open, he mysteriously got a foot injury. And then once the job was filled, he returned to action on the road for the WWF. The majority of the wrestlers fully believed Dusty was coming back, though, and they were extremely nervous. And Dusty stayed by the phone for a couple of days before finding out he wasn't a serious candidate after all. Now, regarding Jarrett, the NWA wanted to work with the USWA as a developmental type group, but once the decision was made regarding Ole, Jarrett decided he didn't want to do that anymore. And the AWA suffered this as well because of his relationship with them. The NWA broke off all their ties completely with AWA, and the AWA is devastated, as there were plans for a Ric Flair versus Larry Zbyszko champion versus champion match on June 23rd in St. Paul. The AWA is now having to refocus their energy on trying to successfully promote the Twin Cities without help from the NWA, which will be difficult to say the least. All right, Bix, before we move on to more of this information, that list of names. The most interesting name on that list, who you think it is? I'm curious to see if you agree with me.
I associate them together. I'm guessing you're thinking Lynn Denner or Roddy Piper, and
I'm thinking Roddy Piper.
Well, I put the two of them together in my head because they were really
they're probably
Portland together.
Yeah.
Because I think the names on that list. I think if I'm running a wrestling company in 1990, I would take a gamble on the two of them.
And the thing is when you do that, you get Piper.
Yeah.
And I think Piper in that area at that time would have been gold. Because he's already still over as hell in Crockett country. And not to mention, how big of a star he was anyway. But you do Piper and Flair. Oof. I mean, Flair, drop the title to Sting. And then have Piper and Flair be the next feud. I mean, amazing stuff, I thought. Just reading
that's it. One of the few things that probably could have given him a shot in the arm at that time. Like a real shot in the arm.
Yes. And if you watch Portland of that era, I mean, Portland television was always entertaining. They always had some great angles going on. And very creative. So there would have been definitely creativity. Much more creativity than what we got with Ole. That's for damn sure. But, J.J. Dillon's on this list. And Dusty's on this list. There's two WF guys. Then you got the Gagnes. And Dundee, Lawler, and Jarrett, who are all USWA guys. And that's a lot of big names on that list. And then you got the NWA-AWA relationship, which they had just ran the show at the Twin Cities on May 5th, the Flair Pillman show.
Twin Wars,
yes. And regarding that, the meeting with Jarrett also involved Lawler, as Herd flew to Dallas on May 4th, and they thought it would be just about being the booker, but it was about a merger between the NWA and USWA, as well as the AWA. As Herd met with Vern the next day in Minneapolis, of course, for that show. But Jarrett called Vern ahead of time, warning him of the deal. Jarrett wanted $4.5 million for his promotion. And he felt like the deal was only going to benefit the NWA, as he and Lawler were going to become nothing but office personnel. Jarrett was also told that the operating deficit for the NWA at the moment was around the $4 million range. Ooh. All right. How about that asking price for the USWA, Bix?
It's a lot, but WCW, I feel like being at what WCW strengths ended up being in a lot of the country is like the last remnant of their territory. Maybe gobbling up the remaining territories is not the worst idea.
And what Jarrett felt like was going to happen was that he immediately told Vern that, you know what they're going to do to us? They're going to do us like they did Mid-South, Florida, and Central States.
Yep.
And that's what would happen. Now, let's say that, okay, I know we're playing hypotheticals, but I love doing it. Let's say that Jarrett agrees to this deal. Not the money, of course, but let's say he agrees to the deal. Him and Lawler go to the NWA. How about Jerry Lawler in 1990 NWA? Let's say, all right, let's say Sting beats Swift for the title. How about Sting Lawler as your title feud?
Sting needed heels.
And Lawler would have been perfect for Sting.
That works.
I mean, it's the... And, you know, Lawler could definitely talk his way into things. So.
They would have had really good matches together, too, I bet.
I really think so as well. It's a match thinking about it. I was like, man, I'd really love to see that match. Because Lawler would have worked smart enough to, you know, have a match based around Sting. To make Sting look good. So, yeah, just thinking about this stuff. All this sound is so much more interesting than what we got. It's hilarious. All right, even more. Okay. Steve Bailey reported that Jim Crockett was offered the job around the 1st of May, as he had been working as a consultant to Jack Petrick regarding the creative efforts of the NWA, and people thought he was going to take the job, but he turned him down. Crockett, though, did openly push for either Dusty Rhodes or J.J. Dillon to get the job, naturally. Gee, I wonder why that was.
I have no idea.
Who were the two guys that was always? I mean, the three guys that was basically in charge of Jim Crockett Promotions at the end was Jim Crockett, Dusty Rhodes, and J.J. Dillon. They were the guys in the Dallas office.
So of course
Crockett would want one of those guys there in that job, but Crockett was like playing the ombudsman of NWA for months. And people were like, why is he was going to live events. He was taking notes. He was doing all this stuff for Jack Petrie. And people were like, what? Why is he here doing this stuff? You know, and that was the reason why. He was setting up for them to make this change. It's crazy. It gets even more crazier in this last bit. The name I forgot to put on the list of candidates, but was even more interesting, was Ted DiBiase. Ted DiBiase's name came up, and Jack Petrie told Matt Watch that DiBiase was suggested by several people as a quality candidate, even though he had never booked before. But Petrie was adamant that he didn't want an active wrestler in the role. How about that? How about Ted DiBiase? Let's say, you know, he leaves WWF.
What kind of rep did he have for ideas and stuff?
I really don't know, because Ted DiBiase has never been anybody linked to any booking position, like was said here. But I think he probably had a great mind for the business. It's just he never really used it. He probably one of those deals where, you know, guys talk, you know, in the locker room
and
stuff like that.
Maybe he booked some of his own programs.
And maybe he did, but he probably would have been still like, okay, that guy. If he got that job, and we've heard this about other people in the wrestling business. Well, if this guy got the booking job, he could probably do it. If they let him.
And by this guy, you mean Bill Watts and Eddie Gilbert,
or just anybody?
But I mean, those are the two people everyone would always talk about.
No, I'm just talking about a guy that did not have experience.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to remember there was one guy back in the day. But listen, Matt, that guy was a booker. He would be awesome. There's one in particular. People used to talk about all the time. In the 2000s.
That was active in the 2000s?
Maybe it's the late 90s, early 2000s. God.
Like a Big Two guy or a...
Yes. Oh, man.
Oh, it's on the tip of my tongue. WWF or
I can't remember, but I always remember that Dave would say it on the Observer shows. Yeah, if that guy was ever a booker, you know, a guy I mean, there's different cases like that. I remember that was said about Scott Levy before he actually did booking.
Where did he book?
Well, he had stuff. Yeah, he was booking stuff in ECW.
Besides his own programs.
His own programs, yeah. But I think that's all he did. But they were like, you know, you could, if he was allowed to do more than that. But there's other examples like that. Guys that, you know, would say, oh, if so-and-so was, you know, they gave him a chance to book, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know,
well, great. Yeah, but you know what? If Brad Armstrong could show his the same personality in front of the camera, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Now, I mentioned the Junkyard Dog was the first guy. He really wasn't the first guy. The first major addition to the roster started in Indianapolis as Stan Hansen made his debut as a guest of the Danger Zone. And he is getting a monster heel push, being groomed for matches against Lex Luger and Sting down the road. Hansen was widely rumored as being WWF bound after putting Hulk Hogan over to Tokyo Dome on April the 13th. Now, Hansen's NWA run. Really good. Really good, I thought. But to me, I think if you ask people about his run, the thing he's remembered about most is the stuff with Missy Hyatt. I mean, wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Missy Hyatt going to the locker room to look for the Z-Man in the shower. And instead being accosted by Stan Hansen. It was at least twice, right?
Definitely twice on pay-per-view. And then you had it was either that or the Desperados.
Looking. Well, but he didn't interact with the Desperados.
I know, but...
They were him after he left.
Yeah. But they were looking for him. But still, though, I mean, he had really strong match with Luger, the match with Vader at WrestleWar 91.
The Sid tag team in syndication.
Yeah, the Sid tag team, house show work with Sting and stuff like that. I mean, he had a good run there, and just it could have been more. And you would have thought, well, Ole there, shit, you know, he would have been pushed harder, but he... He was in, I guess maybe because he was Japan so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's his secondary job. You can't do too much with him.
Yeah, kind of like the Road Warriors in a way. More about them later in the show. So, yeah, kind of like that. Now, but what could be the biggest news story of all broke this week as ComSat, which is one of the largest cable companies in the country based out of Washington, D.C., is interested in purchasing the NWA from TBS. ComSat already has made a big purchase recently buying the Denver Nuggets in the NBA. And the big connection here is that ComSat CEO is Robert Wessler, who was Ted Turner's top aide for many years. NWA officials have denied this story, but enough high-powered sources acknowledge that there's interest from both sides. If such a deal was made, part of the deal would be that ComSat would continue to produce all the weekly television for TBS, as well as syndication, which means nothing visibly would change. All contracts with wrestlers and other personnel would be honored as well. The big thing, though, would be that the number of house shows would be diminished, and there would be more pay-per-views offered, which would wind up being the complete focus of the television. Now, Steve Beverly's sources said, yeah, promotion has their detractors inside Turner, but do you think we would be selling when our key executives don't know anything about it? And another called it an outright lie. Beverly asked Jack Petrick about selling the ComSat. He said that we aren't selling this company to Wessler or anyone else. Why did he say anyone else? Because there's rumors that Titan Sports has also expressed interest in buying the NWA, which would give Vince McMahon his ultimate goal of controlling Major League Professional Wrestling in the United States.
Wouldn't that be fascinating?
Yes. One NWA source told Dave Meltzer that there were discussions months ago. But it was like when Ted Turner was trying to buy the WWF in 1984 and was turned down by Vince back then. Another source told Dave that even if McMahon came up with a better offer and the company was for sale, that Ted Turner would never sell his promotion to Vince because that would be an admission of defeat. All right, Bix, thoughts about the people that are looking at trying to buy the NWA, ComSat, WWF? I mean, this is could have been a potential big deals. Of course, neither happened, but wow. A lot of unrest going on over there at Techwood Drive.
Yeah. And, huh. And I've heard the story before. Actually, you know what? Kill some time for a minute. Let me grab my Matt Watch Farewell yearbook from the other room. Because this addresses that further, and I totally forgot about it until we started covering this now. So go kill some time. I'll be right
back. Okay. All right, the Vince McMahon...
I figure it's more fun if we do it this way than if we stop recording.
Yeah, all right, the Vince McMahon-Ted Turner deal. That was the deal in 1984, of course, when they took over George Championship Wrestling, that Ted wanted this so much that he offered to buy the event from Vince. And then, you know, Vince turned him down because Vince didn't want to sell. And, of course, you know, Ted Turner sold that slot, the TV slot, in the March 85 to Crockett for $1 million. And, yeah, I mean, it changed the game completely. But, you know, once Ted Turner got into the wrestling business in 1989 and became competition to Vince, then that's when their relationship changed. And Ted became his big rival. So now you have Vince wanting to vanquish his rival to become the all-in-all grand poobah of professional wrestling, which, of course, you know, 11 years later would happen. But it's definitely interesting to see 1990 this stuff being talked about.
You timed that really well, by the way. I just got back in. Did my dramatic door closing to try to get on mic show up?
No.
Okay. That's terrible. By the way, though, so was it Steve Beverly or Dave Meltzer that referred to Turner trying to buy the company in 84?
That would be Meltzer.
Because I'm trying to figure out how much credence he's given that in the past.
It was talked. I mean, it was definitely in the cards. I mean, there was definitely talks about that.
I am trying to, because he addresses this in the look back. Because, you know, when we talked about a few weeks ago, we talked about the. Which story that we talked about the hindsight reporting the stuff on? With this Matt Watch thing.
I can't remember.
You remember what I'm talking about, though?
Yeah, I remember we had mentioned it, but I can't remember the story.
I know this is thrilling, everyone, but I totally forgot about this until we started talking. You know what? You want to move on for now and then get back to this when I find the right page?
Well, I can read the next part of it.
That's what I mean, yes.
Yes, because there's more. Here's another issue going on. As the name, the NWA is up in the air. No one in the official board of directors of the NWA is involved with the promotion other than Jim Crockett, and that several disenfranchised board members have discussed filing legal action against WCW for using the NWA name. And there's talk that WCW will start leasing the rights to use the name or drop it altogether. Which, of course, that happened at the end of the year. It took a while, but happened in the year. And most of your disenfranchised board members were like guys like Steve Ricard and more your foreign members that couldn't get dates on the champion anymore and stuff like that. Have you found your spot yet?
No, oddly enough. But the whole name change thing, I mean, they started to push the on-air name thing through not long after this. I mean, by the end of the year, yes. it was exclusively WCW on air.
Yes. It was still like NWA Main Event. The TV shows were like that, but it was changed. But yeah, it was the last
weekend of the year when they changed the shows.
Yeah, and you didn't have like the NWA ring aprons anymore. All of them were mainly by the fall, that had changed completely. The ring aprons and stuff like that. They had the WCW aprons, the World Championship Wrestling, and then your banners and stuff like that. So they had really gone full force with that in the summer and in the fall. But, Jim Crockett, again. His hands are in everything. For a guy who, you know, basically, you know, watched the promotion go down the toilet, here he is, still around with lots of power in the wrestling business.
So far, I have not found this. I have not looked at this in a while, so that's unfortunate. I'll read this. Since it's on point, though, he's talking about Ole. The telephone rang at 5 o'clock at WBBJ last September, which was where he worked. I'm sure you know who this is, so I won't waste any time. I'll get right to it. I've tried to track you down for a week. The voice spewed. I even tried to get your number from WCW, but those people have a combined IQ of about 10. Then, I remembered, you are a friend of Fred Ward's. Suddenly, it struck me. It was Ollie Anderson. Ollie had been out as booker for WCW. Oh, this was a year later. Look here, you idiot. If somebody wants to fight me, let him tell me that himself. And if you don't get, and you don't get that mic out of my face, I'm going to stuff it down your throat.
That's Ollie Anderson right there to the T. I can see him saying that right now.
Yeah. There's more. Let's see.
Well, anyway, as you're looking, Ric Flair's contract status is up in the air. It's a promotion. It's a 2-year contract extension. Ready for him to sign, as they have already signed it themselves, but Flair was precautious because of all the uncertainty about the Booker position. But he has said that he would not sign if he was going to drop the title to Luger, which he's mentioned that on his podcast, that he was not going to drop that title to Lex Luger. We mentioned on this show, they were supposed to drop the title to Lex Luger in Chicago at a house show. He conveniently didn't do that. And there was talks that they were going to try to force it again on the Capital Combat show, and that didn't happen there. So, yeah, Flair stood his ground. One of the few times he ever stood his ground in wrestling. And he won. And so did Sting.
Yep. You know what's wrong with that place? It wasn't me. It was Hurd. I know this is a terrible Ollie, but I got to be a little gruff. Maybe I don't. It was idiots like that who don't know anything about wrestling. I asked, you mean when you told the guys on your first night that you were turning back the clock to 1974, that was wrestling? Said Ollie, I figured you were going to say that, since you wrote about it all the time. Tell me who had the highest ratings on TBS. Tell me who put the highest rated Clash on TBS. I did. I reminded Ollie that while he had the highest rated average Saturday night ratings of any TBS booker, Main Event was as high as a 4.4 and WCW drew a 4.0 during Flair's regime. I also told him that while he had the two highest rated matches in the history in cable history, Flair Luger and Sting Black Scorpion, Sputnik Monroe could have booked those matches and drawn a 6.8. Sputnik a legendarily bad booker.
I don't know Sputnik being a booker.
That's what I was trying to think. I also reminded him that he produced the worst Clash ever. And that Abomination Jacksonville with Luger, Motor City, Man-Man, and the horrendous Sid Vicious Nightstalker affair. I didn't produce that show, Ollie insisted. That those were all people Hurd wanted.
Let me
tell you what happened. I quit the job after 2 weeks. I didn't go to the arenas. I didn't come into the I didn't come into the office half the time. I didn't even really watch the TV all that close. Well, that's certainly fine leadership, I suggested. You know why, he said? Because I had no say over the product. When it came to TV, Jim Ross had to have his input. Tony Schiavone had to have his. Hurd wanted his, and 2/3 of him couldn't pour piss out of a bucket. Things are so bad now. Wouldn't surprise me to see Jack Petrick decide to get rid of wrestling altogether. I confronted him about his first major angle. Excuse me. The racially charged Ric Flair Junkyard Dog Rocky King story in which King played Buckwheat.
Oh, God. Yes.
Look. We had to do something to get people's attention, and they weren't drawing well at the gate because the blacks were staying home. So we tried to do something with shock value to get them back. One thing you can't argue about, the ratings went up with that angle. The conversation ended just abruptly as it began. Look, we're probably going to need to continue this conversation at some point, said Ollie. Here's my phone number. You call it sometime. I may answer it. I may not. I may be in and out. Just depends on what mood I'm in. But you'll want to hear from me again. I haven't yet, but I will say this. Ollie was something else. Well, at least I found that.
Oh, man. Hilarious.
Isn't it amazing how you believe every single word of that, too? Like, it's just, oh, that's Ollie Anderson.
Totally.
I don't say that as a slight against Steve. I'm saying because it's just amazing how Ollie-ish it seems.
Yeah, it fits in perfectly.
Yeah. I cannot find that CanCom Sat thing whatsoever, and I don't know why. But
all right, well, Lex Luger's status...
I had the background of his reporting on it, and I'm frustrated that I can't find it now.
Lex Luger's status for Capital Combat has had everyone worried as he has a staph infection in his leg, and he was still in the hospital trying to make a full recovery, which would make him healthy for his match with Ric Flair at Capital Combat. They are planning on acknowledging Luger's injury on the show and would show footage of him in the hospital, which I don't think ever happened. But if his injury doesn't get better, then he would have to miss the show, which would be a disaster. The promotion handled him missing the house shows over the weekend as good as they could have done, as they had posted outside the building informing the fans that Luger was in the hospital and that Rick Steiner was stubbing for him against Ric Flair. They also announced it on the show and offered refunds.
By the way, twice in less than a year that Ric Flair's house show opponent is out due to a staph infection in the arm.
Yep.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. What's even weirder is, let's say Luger isn't able to wear Capital Combat. What do they do? I mean, there's nothing viably there.
Can't pull Pillman from the tag match, really. It doesn't fit. He's been out of the loop from that.
Elegante's just signed.
Oh, no.
So you ain't gonna put him in the ring.
Don't tell Naylor that he said that.
Alright, so I guess Ric Flair versus RoboCop, I don't know. If Ric Flair, you know, they said Ric Flair could carry a broom to a 3-star match. Let's see what he can do to RoboCop. It'd be interesting to watch RoboCop take bumps.
No, they instead they change the idea and he becomes TV's Peter Weller against Ric Flair.
What do you do? Or you just shoot some real hot angle where, I don't know, maybe you have Wyndham come out turning babyface or something.
Wyndham, who had been back for... Wait, when was Wyndham's return taped?
Like, right around this time. There's really nothing you could do.
And when who came back first, Sid or Wyndham?
Wyndham, right?
Yeah. Of the available options, I think you turn Sid babyface and bring him back that way.
Him or Wyndham. Sid wasn't ready to return yet.
When did Sid come back? I thought he came back right a few couple weeks after Wyndham.
Let's see. Sid Vicious's first match back is on The Clash. The Coastal Crush Clash.
In June?
And that was a 26-second match. So,
when
yeah.
Is that June?
June 13th.
Is that the Joey Maggs match?
No, it's Luger.
So Sid probably wasn't really healthy for a while. Yeah, I guess the solution is Wyndham comes back as a heel first. I mean, as babyface.
Which kills the horseman angle.
But what else do you do? The only other solution is breaking up one of the tag matches on the show, and it's either, you know, one of the Steiners or maybe Pillman.
Well, Wyndham had returned at the... All right. Wyndham was back in April. Maybe that return...
No, because the Worldwide...
On the Worldwide.
So it was the end of April. Because it aired during May. Because it was
aired May 5th, yeah.
It was the first match of sweeps. Okay, so he's already back. When did Luger get the infection after?
Luger was out of the house shows...
Starting
with... the weekend before the pay-per-view. So Luger...
So it has to be one of the Steiners or maybe Pillman.
All right, Pillman. You got Pillman, Rick Steiner, Road Warrior Hawks up for him in Chicago. Luger's last match was in Boston on May the 4th.
I mean, Road Warriors are really not getting pushed, and we'll talk about
that
in a minute.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in a little bit.
I think you go with one of the Steiners. I think
but the Steiners was in the World Tag Title match.
That's what I'm saying. I think you just push back the title change.
JYD.
Oh boy.
Because JYD's there. He's making his return.
Is Orndorff back?
No. Doug Furness?
He's not really getting that big a push.
Flair versus Doug Furness would have been an interesting match.
It would have, but that doesn't really work for them.
I think it would have been Dog. If such a have. I know we're talking again hypotheticals, but I think that would have been the match. But they lucked out. Luger was able, and had a really good match.
Yeah. Not as good as WrestleWar, by no stretch of the imagination. And one of the worst major pay-per-view finishes in wrestling history.
Yes, in that cage. Oh, I hated that style of cage.
Oh, that they use the Thunderdome
cage
for some reason.
Yes.
And by the way, one of my weird favorite childhood wrestling memories, I can't remember, have I told it on here or was it on a different podcast? Is that, yeah, I'm listening to Pro Wrestling Spotlight and stuff, so I know that Ole's the booker, but I don't know how much I understand what that means. So when Ole commandeers the controls of the cage to raise it up and let all the horsemen in, I think that in my head, I was like, oh, he was able to get controls of the cage because he's the booker.
That's what you thought?
Yes.
As a child?
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing.
It makes sense.
It makes sense.
I know that he has this nebulous overlord position.
Yeah. Well, in more ways than one. But yeah, I mean, that finish is just garbage, and the explanation was that woman did it, and that's they suspended her.
And then, and then Ole got controls. They said on the pay-per-view it was Ole.
I know, but they changed it to woman. That's how they explained her being gone.
Right, she got suspended or whatever.
Yeah. WCW, everybody. All right. Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express have signed a new one-year deal with the promotion on May the 14th. We saw how well that went out. Yes, we saw how well that worked out for them. I tell you. Oh, Cornette.
Is that the definitive Jim Herd story, by the way? The negotiations.
Oh, yeah. Well, thing is, why even resign with him?
Why would the Midnights resign? You mean?
Yes! You got all this, I mean, all this stuff's going on, but here you are, resigning with him.
I mean, they were sort of, you know, they're getting the U.S. tag title, so maybe they figured they didn't realize that they were going to lose every house show match.
I know.
But for those who don't know, Cornette was trying to get the same deal. Am I thinking the 89 negotiation where he ended up, where he kept insisting on giving Cornette more money than Dennis and Bobby. I mean, not Dennis, Stan and Bobby.
I don't know. They were, you know, it had been both years. You know, they were only doing one-year deals.
Right, and then there was the whole thing where it was like they were gonna keep Bobby at less money and then bring in Stan on a nightly deal, but eventually they decided to quit, and then the road agents protested, so they offered to resign. And then I forget which year it was, but there was a thing where Herd kept insisting on offering Jim more money than Stan and Bobby. Jim would constantly be like, no, it's just, you know, the same we always got, you know, from every promoter, you know, the same money between the three, you know, for each of us. And Herd would always be like, you know, if it was Stan and Bobby get 125, Jim would get 150.
Yeah.
Because he's like, oh, but we can also use you to do the hotline and announcing and whatever. And eventually they just gave in to it. Once he at least got Stan and Bobby up to the level.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny that, you know, it was, what, let's say 5 months later is when they leave. So they did about less than half of what their extension was.
Yes.
But
and then the whole thing where he wouldn't buy them out because Herd didn't want to set that precedent. And then, 2 years later, sets that precedent with Jimmy Garvin.
Yeah, well, Herd wasn't there then.
Was it her? Well, wait, am I thinking? Wait, then what am I thinking of?
Herb was long gone.
Right, because Herb's gone when Jimmy Garvin left. So wait, what am I thinking of then? Because I thought it was Jimmy Garvin. Maybe it wasn't Herb. Maybe it was someone else then.
Yeah.
Did Petrick stick around after Herb?
Bob Dew was in charge, I think, by then. I think. Oh, there's so much.
It all gets confusing.
Teddy Long, who I saw compete over the weekend at the WrestleAmerica show here in Barnesville as the general manager of WrestleAmerica, which I hope he makes a regular position, caused some issues here as he didn't know until May 14th that he was losing his hair match with Paul Ellering at Capital Combat, especially with Ellering leaving. But cooler heads prevailed and everything worked out in the end. Yeah. Paul Ellering, who's leaving town, wins in his final match. And Teddy Long gets his head shaved. I mean, yes, to pay off a big angle, but still. If you were Teddy Long, wouldn't you think that was shady?
Let's face it, this company has done many more shady things. Many things shadier to Teddy Long than that.
Or as Oli would say, to the blacks.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, this was the beginning of the blacks being screwed by Oli Anderson. That's for damn sure. Although Thunderbolt Patterson was coming in soon for a job, so I guess it all wasn't bad, was it?
Yes, he was coming in to want to manage the Steiner brothers.
Yes. Eddie Gilbert has suffered a torn rotator cuff. And it's off the and it's off the Capital Combat show where he was supposed to team with Tommy Rich and Mike Rotundo against the Wild Samoans. Yes. The theme show Emergency featuring lead actor Robert Fuller. No relation.
It wasn't a gimmick. His dick was that long.
No relation to the Tennessee Stud. Who had a birthday?
Yeah, so for those who don't know why I was laughing like that.
Well, hold on. Let me finish telling a story.
Okay.
Because it leads into what you're going to say.
All right.
Gilbert, who was getting ready to quit wrestling, to prove to the bosses that he was serious about being the booker, suffered this injury was terrible. Because Gilbert wanted the booking job too. But go ahead, tell the story.
He ends up saying, look, it looks like I can't wrestle at all on this. I don't want to be, I don't want to be a burden on you. I don't want to get paid if I'm not wrestling. So just let me go. I'll go home. If I'll work for Jarrett, maybe I'll book for him, but I won't do anything else. I won't be on TV. They give him his release. That weekend, he shows up on Memphis TV shooting a new angle with Lawler.
God bless Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. I'm telling you. He was the gift that kept on giving for many years in wrestling. But in some real injury news, Nick Patrick tore his patella tendon in his knee, which was the same injury Sting suffered, take a bump outside the ring in Chicago on May 13th, and is out indefinitely. Tommy Young, who was still recovering from his spinal surgery, was told by his doctors that he won't be able to return for a long time. Well, it was a real long time. But, Nick Patrick, who, was at that time, WCW's now lead official, he's gone. So, if I'm official on WCW, and I'm saying this, I'm like, these two major injuries take place in a 7-month time span. I'm kind of nervous. Would you be, Vix?
Yeah, and who do we know who was in the match that Nick Patrick was refereeing when he blew out his knee?
Oh, let's see.
Really hope it wasn't Tommy Rich.
No, Tommy Rich was actually not on that show. Let's read the results of that show, though. It falls in our week. USC Pavilion drawing 2,471. It's number of fans. Oof. Robbie Idol defeated Ned Brady. Nasty Ned Brady.
Why are you bringing in Florida indie guys to fill out a show in Chicago?
Bam Bam Bigelow pinned Johnny Stewart.
Okay, at least he's local-ish.
Kevin Sullivan pinned...
Oh, actually, wasn't Johnny Stewart technically working for WCW at the time?
Yes, he had just quit AWA. Okay. Kevin Sullivan pinned Rick Ryder. The Samoan SWAT team pinned Brian Pillman and Paul Drake, not the detective on Perry Mason, subbing for Tom Zink, who was injured in Detroit the night before. Road Warrior Animal and Mike Rotunda beat the Midnight Express. The Steiner Brothers beat Doom. And Road Warrior Hog beat Ric Flair by DQ after Woman gave him a foreign object.
WCW, everybody.
I'm looking at some of the other house shows for that week. It's a shame we don't have some results from the Hazard, Kentucky, and Knoxville show. I'm just saying, it's a shame we don't have it. I'm sure Bo James would have. He might have.
Do you have the lineup?
No, there's no nothing. Okay. Listen to this show. You know where Tommy Rich was in Chicago. Besides Chicago, they ran two shows that night.
Because if any company needs to run split crews, it's WCW 1990.
Any guess of where he's at?
Okay, WCW is running split crews. From what you're saying, it's a place that they should not be running.
Oh, absolutely.
Were the Midnights on the Chicago show?
Yes.
Because I'm trying to think based on the Midnights. Okay, I'm going to guess... Maybe this is someplace they went back to. Okay, is this in Canada?
No.
Is this so? It's in the continental United States.
Barely, yes.
So this is some kind of coastal city?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Is it in Maine?
No. One more guess. You're way away.
Albuquerque?
No, but you're closer. All right. And what coast are they near? They ran Galveston, Mexico? Texas, at the Moody Center on May 13th in front of 300 fans.
Where in Texas?
Galveston.
Oh, Galveston.
Listen to this lineup. Manuel Villalobos defeated
Manny Villalobos.
Dino Hernandez. handicap match. Mean Mark Callis defeated the Cajun Predator and Brad Anderson. Tommy Rich pinned Dutch Mantel.
For the love of God, why are they running split crew? They have to.
Norman pinned Cactus Jack. And your main event, the Rock and Roll Express defeated the Fabulous Freebirds.
Was the Southern Tag Team Trophy on the line?
Not yet. But wow. Yes, they're running split crews in 1990. Jesus Christ. And like I said, we don't know what match Nick Patrick injured himself in. Chris Cruz has a June starting date to work for CNN Headline News, but there's talk that Cruz will be brought back to the NWA to work with Paul Lee Danielson on the Power Hour to cut back on overexposing Jim Ross. Cruz has agreed, though, to work for the OPWA in the fall. So,
did he end up working any tapings for them?
What, OPWA?
Yeah, I don't remember him being there.
I think he may have, but I don't remember it either.
Because
there was two shows. You remember LPW had two TV shows?
They did?
Yes.
I don't remember this. What, one on Sports Channel America, one in syndication?
Yes, I think so. At the beginning. But how about that? The cut back on overexposing Jim Ross. Because folks that don't remember,
he hosted almost every show back
then. He was every TV show.
And he was on every show on TBS.
Except worldwide. But at one point, 89, he was worldwide too. He was every show.
Well, he wasn't on pro with the, he was on pro in New York. He wasn't on pro and in the places that got WPIX on cable. But he was on the TBS shows, yeah.
He would announce on the syndicated pro shows too.
No, but only no. It was because it was Lance and the Freebirds.
No, in 89.
Oh no, I was talking about 90.
Yeah, I'm talking about 89. Yeah, I was gonna say 89. He was very overexposed. Well, but I mean, I like Jim Ross, so it didn't matter.
Well, because they had planned on having him as the voice of TBS and Shivani as the voice of syndication. Then Shivani was like, screw that, and quit.
Yeah.
So then they needed someone for syndication, and I guess that was sort of supposed to be Lance Russell, but then that wasn't quite what they did with him.
Lance would announce, but he wasn't like the main host of the shows. They would just have different announcer groups, different announcers doing different things. But yeah, I mean, if you didn't like Jim Ross, yeah, I guess you could see overexposure, but I like Jim Ross. So it didn't matter to me. And of course, Chris Cruz didn't come back to this company until 94.
Sounds right.
Yeah. So anyway, Dutch Mantel made his TV debut on May 12th on the episode of World Championship Wrestling, taped on April 24th at Center Stage in Atlanta, beating Paul Drake. No, Hamilton Burger did not send Dutch Mantel to beat Paul Drake. And that's only a joke that you Perry Mason fans will enjoy. Which, on, do you ever watch Perry Mason, Bix?
The original or the...
The original, the TV show.
No, I mean the original or the weird remake for old people.
No, the TV show. The original. Not the TV movies.
Okay. I've very rarely seen the original.
Because the TV movies, the guy that played Paul Drake was dead. So William Catt, who was the greatest American hero, played Paul Drake's son. Which, in real life, William Catt was the son of Perry Mason's secretary, Della. But anyway, Hamilton Burger was always... more often than not, the guy that faced off Perry Mason in court. He was the lead district attorney for Los Angeles.
He was the city. What's the name of the prosecutor in the Phoenix Wright games? I was going to say is his counterpart, but now I can't remember the nick of the guy's name. The whatever to his Phoenix Wright.
But he was the lead prosecutor for city of Los Angeles, and Perry Mason, in the whole history of the show, only lost 3 cases.
Because his clients were guilty?
No, he only lost 3 cases because he would always find the real killers.
No, but I'm saying, so were his clients guilty in the ones that he lost?
Well, the three he... Well, one of them was. Two of the ones he lost, he avenged later in the show. Huh? Yeah, they would have a case early, then they would come back and do a appeal, a retrial.
Oh,
and he would,
the same episode.
Yeah, he would avenge their conviction. So, yeah, and Hamilton Burger was mainly the guy who lost all the cases. So what a record he had. And Paul Drake was Perry Mason's lead investigator. So I watch a lot of Perry Mason because it's on MeTV, and they, on the nights after work, before I go to sleep, I always turn it on there, and I watch, you know, the last half of the show where they get to the court stuff. And it's just really fun television.
Miles Edgeworth. That's who I was thinking of.
Okay.
Paul Drake was the Miles Edgeworth to Phoenix Wright.
Yeah, there you go. Perry Mason. And in our final NWA note, Brad Armstrong, who Vix mentioned earlier, is getting repackaged as the Candyman with a tie-in with M&M's.
Is that really why they did it?
That was what was being reported in the newsletters. And it didn't happen.
The Candyman happened.
Candyman happened. Who can make the sun rise? The Candyman can.
What a weird use of Brad Armstrong. And then Tim Horner comes back and they reform the Lightning Express again.
Yes.
As they do every time.
And have kick-ass tag matches with Arn Anderson and Barry Windham on television.
Yeah, and... I remember, do you remember seeing the Candyman, Brad Armstrong? Is, I think, maybe even just the Candyman, I am Brad Armstrong on Family Feud.
Yes, which was right around this time.
He was on the syndicated Family Feud, right? He was not on the CBS Family Feud, right?
Yeah.
He was on the nighttime Family Feud.
Yes.
Which was like the stepchild of the redheaded stepchild of the WCW on Family Feud episodes, right?
Yes.
Because it was, let's see, because... I'm trying to remember who was on the nighttime version at this time. Who was the? It was like Tony Schiavone, Dutch Mantel.
Oh Jesus!
Candyman, Brad Armstrong. I might be confusing a couple different runs together. Kevin Let's Nash see. As Master Blaster or Steel.
Here he is with Sting, Z-Man, Brian Pillman, and Jim Ross.
Okay, wait a second. No, you're right. That's right. He was on the daytime version.
Yes. Sting was
on the daytime version. That's right. I saw it at the time. But the night.
Jim Ross in a suit. He's the only one in a suit. Brad's wearing a polo shirt.
He's Pillman wearing a red polo shirt and matching sunglasses because he's the Candyman.
Yeah, Pillman and Zink are in tank top. Sting's in his tank top and tights with the NWA title belt around his waist. And they faced off against Glow.
It's almost like Glow only existed until 1990 to compete against WCW on Family Feud.
I think so. Amazing.
Did anyone watch? Did anyone remember watching 1990 Vintage Glow?
The last I remember watching a Glow was like in 88.
I know. And then Jackie Stallone as the new owner.
I remember that angle. I remember that, but I didn't watch it. But I remember reading about that. I'm like, oh my god!
Wasn't Jackie Stallone doing like commercials for
Psychic Hotlines?
Wasn't she doing commercials for like a gym too, or something around that?
Something like that, yeah.
Like for Bally's or something.
Yes, Bally's. Man,
I think this it was when Bally's was Bally's Jack LaLanne. I think there was a time where I was a little kid where I thought that she was somehow named Jack LaLanne.
This is stuff that we don't have anymore. And television is not what it used to be, folks. It just really isn't. It's sad.
Oh, that we have nothing like... What? Like, do you mean Glow or Wrestlers on Family?
Just period.
Everything.
The stuff we're talking about, Bally's commercials with Jackie Stallone. You know, and just stuff like that. You don't see that stuff anymore.
Commercials have to be adorable and have Kristen Bell and Dax Shepard and Sloth Cakes.
And Tina Fey.
Yeah. Let me see. Okay, wait. The family...
It's gotta be quirky and... Gotta be inside humor and stuff like that.
All right, here we go. WCW's team, and oh right, I put this on YouTube. That's right. WCW's team on the nighttime version later that year. Do you remember who it was?
No.
Sid Vicious, Dutch Mantel, Master Blaster Steel, Tony Schiavone, and it says Kevin. Wait, Kevin. Because I'm looking at the beginning of the description. That was the beginning of the video. Kevin Sullivan. Kevin Sullivan was around when Kevin Nash was?
He was a worldwide announcer.
I thought he was gone by then. Nancy was gone months before Kevin. Then.
Yes, Kevin was the Tony's announcer on Worldwide.
I thought it was Dutch.
Other man. No, Dutch took Kevin's spot. Hilarious.
I knew Dutch replaced Kevin, but I thought...
No.
Because Master Blaster Steel's not around till the fall.
Kevin was around then, too. Kevin was around a while.
Let's see how Sid does on Family Feud.
Killer answer to this question. Thank you, Steel. Here we go. Name something you usually do after eating a big meal. Sid?
Brush your teeth.
He says he brushes his teeth. It's not there. Hollywood. Stay right here, Sid. Name something you usually do after eating a big meal. Six answers give you control.
Put a toothpick. Do the toothpick deal.
All right. Do the toothpick deal.
That's in the bathroom.
Stay here, Sid. Don't say a word. Shh, quietly. Shh. Stay here, Sid. Dirty. Here's the question. Name something you usually do.
He's calling Dutch Mantel dirty.
After eating a big meal.
I watch TV.
Let me see. Television. It's there, but don't move. Don't move. Stay here. I'm going to the farmer's daughter. Two answers will give you...
Which farmer's daughter is this?
Why is he making them stay there?
Because neither of them got one that was on the board.
Yeah, Dutch just did.
No, but that now he needs to see if they get she gets a higher one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Control something you usually do after eating a big meal. Quickly.
Exercise.
Show me...
Well, like, in Glow, you do that, but normal people don't do that immediately.
I thought you were saying throw up.
Not there. Jesus you think
Christ.
Of a seal, Hollywood.
Can you imagine if that aired today?
What do you do, Hollywood? What do you do after a big meal? Vomit. Oh, God.
Exercise bulimia is still bulimia, everybody.
Yes. Amazing.
Oh, wait, Kevin Nash
nicely done, Dirty. Good job.
So let's just hear this first.
About coffee!
After eating a big meal.
Coffee!
One strike. Now, right now, I'm going to ask for calm on this stage. There's only $8. Gentlemen, I know how badly you want to win this, so just think so you can get some points. Number one is there, Tony. Something you usually do.
As you can tell by my girth, it's probably going to be go to sleep.
Sleeping. Number one. Good job. Kevin, we put some money in the bank now. $61, something you usually do after eating a big meal.
Smoke.
Okay.
Kevin, it's almost smoking.
Perhaps smoke.
Well, maybe not a cigarette. Maybe not a regular cigarette.
Okay. There it is. Doesn't that bank go for $66? Sid Vicious, keep it rolling. Have dessert. After eating a big meal, Sid says he has dessert.
Sid actually has good answers.
I know.
They just don't happen to be on the board for some reason.
They're taunting you, Sid. Dirty, if you don't give me an answer, the Glow women are going to try to steal $66.
This is a big, big meal. I imagine.
It's a big meal.
Go to the bathroom.
There you go.
Only Dirty Dutch would say that as soon as he finishes eating, he goes to the bathroom. $66.
Let's see this one through to the end, I guess, now. And then.
Yeah, might as well.
Name something specific.
That's right. Whoever taped this edited out the Glow Girls. I remember once a YouTube commenter was very angry about that. So
I'm sure they were. And now let's go to our international section this week. Which is mainly just Japan and one little tidbit from Mexico. And when I was picked this week out to do the show, I totally forgot about what else happened this week in a major, major news story, which actually probably overshadows anything else that happened in the long run this week. But before we get to that, let's go with this All Japan news as we go to All Japan Pro Wrestling. And it's being discussed that All Japan and New Japan will work together more to stave off the challenge of the newly formed Super World Sports. Giant Baba had a choice of New Japan Gaijin to use on the June 8th Budokan show in exchange for New Japan using Stan Hansen on their June 12th show in Fukuoka. And Baba picked Bam Bam Bigelow over Big Van Vader because he felt that Bigelow was the better worker. Fix.
Well, were you not a fan of that dun-dun-dun?
Yeah, well, it makes sense. But, Bix, I guess it's this 1990 we got to look at. Vader is starting to really come into his own here, but Bigelow had the cachet. I guess you could say had the better look.
He was still considered the guy with more upside.
Yes, guy with more upside. And, of course, this would not really be a problem between the sheets without Bam Bam Bigelow being mentioned, but, thoughts about Baba's mindset here?
I think you can make an argument for Bigelow being the better worker in 91.
What about 90?
I mean, 90. Excuse me. Not. I meant 90. In 90. I think 91 is really when Vader definitively gets better.
I agree.
But, I mean, I'm trying to think about this. So, New Japan. Now, did Hansen work any matches other than the ones against Vader for New Japan?
I think that's really all he worked against. That's all I remember. That's the most notable matches. But you would have thought if he worked against any of the other New Japan guys, it would have been, you know, really notable and out there.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I think Vader, even at this point, probably still would have been a better fit in All Japan. Style-wise?
Yeah.
Than Bigelow? Because even though he's not quite all the way there yet, he's still... And this is still a different version of the All Japan style from the one that he'd work later. I think he fits in better with what he does with the, you know, stiff style. That it translates better than Bigelow, who's... I mean, Bigelow at this point... Honestly, Bigelow, he's good, but he didn't have that much at this point. You know what I mean? this is kind of like, this is an in between period. He just, he wasn't, what's the word I'm looking? You get what I'm trying to say though.
Yeah. He had been in NWA. Didn't really impress there. So this is right after that. He still had his tough guy rep. He was still athletic. But yeah, I mean, this is the period where he's like a nomad before he, you know, him and Vader actually become the dominant tag team. You know?
Well, this is part of the talent sharing thing, though. I mean, well,
yeah, I know.
Yes, he's a nomad. Yeah. Here, he's still a New Japan. Otherwise, he's a New Japan guy. I mean, he's a nomad because he's just working different places between New Japan tours.
Yeah, he's basically he's a New Japan regular.
And then, of course, he ends up screwing it up with Baba because no one taught him how to not screw it up with Baba.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell the story since I'm the one that always tells these?
No, you do such a great job of telling it. You got to keep on doing it. Yes.
Okay, so, of course, as we just discussed, Bigelow goes to All Japan as part of the talent exchange to fight off the SWS. And this was at the end of his first tour. He only did one tour, right?
Oh, no, he had been in Japan in the 80s.
No, for Baba.
Oh, yes.
End of the tour, gets his pay. Because he had been working for Inoki, he always counted the money while he was there. No one taught him that you don't have to do that in All Japan, especially in front of Baba.
Big mistake.
And it was seen as...
That's also a sign of disrespect, yeah.
It's a sign of disrespect. He was seen as not trusting. That was it. And when did he go back to New Japan? Did he go back immediately, or was there a break?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, he was in New Japan later on in 90.
And then he was with New Japan until he went to WWF, right?
Yes. So him and Vader became the Ring of the Tag Team, dominated the tag team scene for a while there. So, yeah. It was interesting. Bigelow and Vader.
Which of the famous Bigelow and Vader tags do you like better? The one against the Steiners or the one against, was it Muto and Hase, I think? The one everyone always talks about, the Steiners match, but I like the Muto and Hase match.
I think I like the Muto Hase match better. But I think the Steiners match is one of those deals where, yeah, one's a better match, but one's like the more memorable match.
Yeah, but honestly, I think for what the Steiners match is trying to do, I think you can make an argument that Vader and Mr. Hughes versus Steiners is a better match.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely
it's the same type of match.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all good.
With them throwing around the big guys. They're all good, but I think I like the drama and the blood and all that in the Hase.
Well, the blood definitely helps. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
I'm trying to remember. It's Hase that bleeds in that one, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Everyone forgets how much Hase used to bleed.
Yeah.
Now they always talk about Muto.
Yeah, well,
Hase bled more than most of the time.
Muto had that one, you know, epic job. And
well, too. There was the Flair match, too.
Yeah.
In the G1.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's known for that. And once you get known for something like that, it sticks with you.
I remember the tape list that LNS Comics, which was the comic store near here that was a sponsor on John Arezzi's show that had all the wrestling stuff, their tape list, and I never bought tapes from them, although I heard that they did not have the best rep as far as selling tapes, that I remember on their Japan list, they started using the abbreviation BLH to stand for Bleeds Like Hell or Bleeds Like Hase. For any match with a lot of blood. So.
Yeah.
It used to be, it was him that had the rep, and then I guess the Muda match was the one that people watched.
Yeah. It's the most known one. Alright. Now we get to the big news here. The first part, in their first All Japan show, post Tenryu Ganichiro at Korakuen Hall on May 14th. Giant Baba did a clean job to Terry Gordy in a tag match featuring Gordy and Dr. Death against Baba and Jumbo Sharuda, where Baba was pinned after a powerbomb in a lariat. Baba demanded the guys work hard with him during the match, and he was shook up badly afterwards as Doc nearly knocked him out. The fans were crazy for what they saw, though. So, yeah, I mean, that's... Even though Baba was... You know, nowhere near what he was. He was still Giant Baba and did not do jobs. So for him to do a clean job for Terry Gordy, I mean, it was a huge deal at this time period.
Was this a TV taping?
Yes.
I'm trying to think if I've ever seen this. I don't think I have.
I'm pretty sure it is. I will check to be absolutely positive.
Well, I would think if Bob is doing a job, then...
Yeah, and Corkin.
At Corkin.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at Corkin, I mean, that should be... Corkin shows usually were always taped. But I'm checking to make sure.
I mean, even later on, I'm trying to figure out how many jobs he ever did.
And this is, well, and also this makes sense for what's about to happen with Gordy. Because Gordy's about to win the Triple Crown.
Yes. Not that it lasted long.
No, it didn't last long. But he's about to win the Triple Crown. And getting that pin over Baba, huge deal. Yes, it's a television taping. And it wasn't at Corkin Hall either. I guess the Dave got the wrong information or something. It was at Tokyo Metropolitan Gym. And drew 8,200 fans. Now, if you want to hear the rest of the card, other than one match, which we'll talk about in a second, listen to this card, folks. Mitsuo Momota beats Masaru Orihara in your opener. That's right, young boy Orihara before he leaves.
How much longer before he leaves, since Tenryu already left?
Not long, because you have some other names mentioned here too. Akira Taue, Shinichi Nakano, and Shunji Takano defeated Kenta Kobashi, Tatsumi Kirihara, and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi.
And I think, was it exactly half of those guys were about to leave?
Yes. All right, Johnny Smith beats Isamu Tsurunishi. Then your old guy, six man, Mighty Inoue, Rush Okamura, and Great Kabuki over Haruka Aigen, Masafuchi, and Motoshi Okuma.
Listen, Kabuki was sort of still being pushed.
Yeah, listen to this tag match. Goro Shirumi and Tiger Jeet Singh defeated Abdullah the Butcher and Mark Scarpa. One of these does not fit.
Did Goro Shirumi go to war?
Because
I don't remember being around after this.
I think he left. He may have went to he was all over the scene. He was going here and there. But I think he stayed in all Japan for a lot longer than this.
Okay.
Listen to this singles match. Davey Boy Smith beat Dusty Rhodes Jr. That's right. Dustin Rhodes worked in all Japan as Dusty Rhodes Jr.
That was always his name in Japan. When he worked in New Japan, that was his name.
Yep. So, and another match which we're about to talk about. So, yeah, I mean, interesting show there. Now,
at the top, he always did jobs when he needed to, though.
Yeah, and I guess like Gordy's about to get the Triple Crown. So, and they had to do something to change it up because Tenryu was the guy.
Well, and there's another something coming in a minute.
Yeah, and I said they had to do something to change it up. And at the time, the Baba angle seemed like the major story. But an even larger story happened in the match before it, as Toshiaki Kawada teamed up with Tiger Mask 2 to face off with Samson Fuyuki and Yoshiaki Yatsu. Now, Footloose had broke up, and they were wearing new attire, which basically became their classic 90s look, which Kawada in the black and yellow, and as Dave said at the time, look, a UWF guy, and then Fuyuki in the short tights, and you know, so on. But the big story came after the match, as Kawada untied Tiger Mask, revealing Mitsuhara Misawa, who yelled out, "I am Misawa," before throwing his mask in the crowd. Misawa pinned Fuyuki in the match, and then challenged Jumbo Shooter to a shot at his Triple Crown on June 8th at Budokan. The next day, Misawa vacated the All-Asian tag titles they held with Kenta Kobashi, after beating Davey Boy and Johnny Smith in Hiroshima. And since this has happened, Misawa has worked as himself, but in his classic attire, what he, you know, he wore for the rest of his career.
Actually, I pulled it up.
Kawada,
yes. He's changed his gear, but he's wearing the blue and gold still. He hasn't switched to the...
Okay.
He switched That's out right. the Footloose gear, but he's wearing the other gear that he had for a while.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. He had that for a short time.
And he's still not surly Kawada, because like
no.
When was the Kobashi singles match from TV? It was around this time, right?
Not too long after this.
Because at that match, he's still, you know, high-flying Kawada.
Well, Kawada, I mean, Kawada, I wouldn't say he really got surly until maybe going 91-ish. I think that grew. But
he's still high-flying Kawada. He hasn't changed his style at all yet.
Yeah.
Like, he does a springboard somersault plancha during that match.
Yeah.
Kawada against Kobashi in a singles match in All Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yes. And this was a huge deal, of course.
Yeah,
I mean, this lays
the unmasking.
This lays the groundwork for All Japan for the rest of the decade and going into Noah. And Tiger Mask 2, I always thought was a disappointment. Of course, I mean, you compare it to Sayama, and it's no comparison, but...
Well, it's not just as a Tiger Mask. It just didn't work for him at all.
It just never fit Misawa. It just never fit him, and it held him back for years. And we saw all these great things that he did after he unmasked. Who wonders what he could have done before he unmasked? I mean, if he had not even really taken that gimmick or whatever. I mean, he lost a half of a decade. I mean, Tiger Mask 2, there was some good things that Tiger Mask 2 was part of, but overall, in general, it was a disappointment. Well, I mean, you agree, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm just trying to think, like, other than the early matches where he's a junior heavyweight, and then, like, what, that one jumbo match? Is there anything really memorable that you can think of from Tiger Mask 2?
There was a jumbo match from 88.
The jumbo match.
So, that's about it, really, mainly. A Crockett Cup, I guess.
That's not why it's memorable.
No. So, yeah, I mean...
Think of anything you can think of with him, like all the big the big matches with the foreigners that we can... are all kind of disappointing. The Brent match, the Flair match, the Steamboat match...
Yeah, it's a definite what could have been, but it's a big angle, huge angle. And of course, they never worked for the Triple Crown because Jumbo lost the title 2 days earlier to Gordy. So that's why, you know, they went to the singles match at Budokan. There was no title on the line.
Now, why did they stick with the Tiger Mask 2 thing so long? Had Baba signed a contract that he was stuck with or something?
I really don't know an answer to that question. I really don't. I don't think so. I just think that was just something that they they didn't have any plans for him other than that, I guess. And Tenru leaving. Who knows? If Tenru doesn't leave, who knows? You know, Tenru leaving forced their hand. They had to do something.
I apologize for that noise, by the way. I just pumped into my mic stand. I wish we could have gotten a big Tenru Misawa match, though.
Oh, God, yes.
And also, by the way, for everyone listening, we just sounded out of sync a little a minute ago. It's because I think there were some Skype issues going on that seemed to have repaired themselves.
Yeah, we're good now. But, yeah, I mean, that's the one match, well, you know, other than Tenru against Kawada and a big single or something like that, of that era, which we eventually got, and it was still a great match,
and Tenru
Kobashi.
Tenru Kobashi, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting era because this is the beginning, you know, we talked about last week, 93, about how the Japanese scene was so hot, you know, all these different motions. And now we're in the beginning of that era as All Japan and New Japan had dominated for so long. FMW, who we're going to talk about in a few minutes, is in their infancy stages. Universal Lucha Libre is going on this time period.
Second UWF is still strong,
but there's really nothing going on. That's why an SWS type promotion was a big deal. And go into SWS. Tenryu is coming to the United States next month to scout American talent for his new group, which is scheduled to start sometime over the summer. And there hasn't been any announcements so far regarding talent, but Tenryu is hopeful of getting either Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair to work against him to help get the group off the ground. Tenryu's plan is to run 4 or 5 major shows per month instead of nightly tours that last 4 to 5 weeks, which has been a tradition in Japan until the UWF changed everyone's perception of how wrestling could be promoted. So, yeah, UWF changed the game for a lot of things. You know, running their big individual monthly shows with no television and drawing huge houses. So, and Tenryu, of course, would hook up with WWF. So that would be his deal. Although there was always a deal with Flair and Tenryu, where Flair loved work, you know, Tenryu. We talked about that on various shows. We talked about that on the death of JCP, where Flair was wanting to bring Tenryu in and push him.
He wanted to bring him in for Starrcade 88, didn't he?
Yeah, he wanted to change the style of the way the Cup promotion was going. So more of that style. So, yeah, and Tenryu was such a big deal in this time period. Would you say he was maybe the biggest star in Japan at this time, wrestling-wise? He was the guy?
If he's not, he's right there.
I can't think of anybody else. I mean, Jumbo's Triple Crown champion, yes. And, of course, New Japan had their guys. But, you looking at it, Tenryu just seemed like he was the guy in the country.
Yes. I mean, I'm trying to think. There's really not anyone in New Japan at that moment that you can really put over him.
Choshu, maybe.
Maybe. But the Three Musketeers aren't quite there yet.
Well, Muda's just got back.
Right.
You know? And, of course, yeah, the Musketeers are still young. Hashimoto's been IWGP champion. So he's starting to get up there.
But he's Fujinami, not a bigger star yet, by any means.
Fujinami is coming off injury. So, yeah. It's Tenryu, basically. And SWS was successful for a while there. But, things happened.
They always had to give away a lot of tickets, though, didn't they?
Yeah, but still, they were successful. But I guess mainly because they had big money in it. And regarding that, while a deal hasn't been announced yet, it looks like Megami Super will sponsor a weekly TV show for SWS, not to mention their own monthly magazine. Plus, it looks like KY Wakamatsu will be a key figure for the group, trying to lure other Japanese stars to join. And Wakamatsu has already told the press that the SWS will be the Japanese version of the WWF with their new way of promoting wrestling.
I gotta say, I love that I have a question. Did it say KY Wakamatsu in the Observer? Or did it say Ishimisa Wakamatsu?
Ishimisa, you know.
Because I was gonna say, even then, still though, I love that everyone just ended up calling him the joke name that Bruce Hart gave him.
Yeah, I mean, he's known for that name. I mean, that's his defending name.
In Japan, do people call him KY?
I just think they just called him Wakamatsu.
Okay.
Mr. Wakamatsu and stuff like that. But he's more known here, and that's what I was going to say.
No, in the West, he's known as KY Wakamatsu.
Yeah, and I was going to do two things. I was going to get you to A, talk about Megami Super, and B, talk about Wakamatsu.
Okay.
For people that don't know.
So when did he wrestle in the first place?
Well, he was wrestling. He wrestled in Stampede.
No, but I'm saying when was it? But before he in Japan, like when was he a wrestler and with which promotion?
Oh God! He was a New Japan guy. I don't know if he actually wrestled. He wrestled in 73. So there you go.
Okay, that's what I thought. I figured he was an older, like one of those. Yeah, because there were all those New Japan undercard guys from that era that just kind of vanished. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he started like 1983.
Shibata, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Shibata's father.
Yeah, well, he became a referee.
But still, you know what I mean? There were a lot of wrestlers, but that's to stop wrestling, though. There were a lot of guys that were undercard guys. Yeah, I know he became a referee, but there were a lot of guys that became... That was a bad example. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, that there are a lot, there are other guys. I can't remember all the names right now. There are other guys from that era that just kind of didn't really.
He was
stick
part
around.
Of that. He was part of the Tokyo Sports All-Star Dream Battle Royal on that show in August 26, 1979.
Okay.
At Budokan. That, which, for those of you who don't know what that show was, that was the first time All Japan and New Japan had worked together.
Wasn't IWE part of that show too?
And IWE was part of that show. Now here's if here's the 19 people that part of that show.
Okay, I mean, and, I'll explain Wakamatsu and.
Kotetsu Yamamoto, he won it, of course. That was the guy, the short ball guy who was New Japan's color announcer for many, many years.
And one of the main trainers in the dojo.
One of the main trainers, yeah. Akira Maeda, Atsushi Anita, Devil Murasaki, George Takano, Goro Shirumi, Hiro Saito, Wakamatsu, Junji Harada, Kasuji Kai, who nobody knows, Kazuharu Sonoda, of course, Magic Dragon, Kuniaki Kobayashi, Masahiko Takasugi, who would become Ultra 7, Masafuchi, Masao Ito, Mitsuo Momota, Mr. Hayashi, not a Kazuo Hayashi, Muniyori Higo, and Tsutomu Yonemura.
So who's Devil Murasaki, Mr. Hayashi, and the last two guys?
Devil Murasaki worked...
I know the name, but I can't place him.
He was just a regular Japanese wrestler in the 70s. And I think he retired in 81. He worked all over the place. Mr. Hayashi was Taru Hayashi in the States. He worked many years. He worked in the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, retired and became a referee. And who was the other one?
The other one, who's the, like the last one or the next last one you mentioned?
The last one, Tsutomu Yonemura.
Wasn't there someone else like an Iho or someone too that you?
Muninori Higo.
Yes, who's Higo?
Higo was known as also as Sushi Hongo.
Okay, that sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah, he worked around. And Kasuji Kai. I mean, I don't know who that guy was, but
all right, so. Ishimitsu, Wakamatsu.
Yeah, guys like that. I mean, they just faded away.
So Wakamatsu, you know, New Japan prelim guy, ends up in Calgary for whatever reason, working for Stu Hart. And Bruce Hart decides to make him a heel manager as KY Wakamatsu. And yes, the KY comes from where you think it came from. And he was good for what his role was. Would you say?
Yeah, he was effective.
Yeah, he's not cutting promos, but for what he was trying to do, he was good. And I guess then New Japan brings him back with the machines.
Yep.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that where I guess they got the idea for him to be a manager from Bruce Hart using him, right?
Yes.
And, of course, then... Vince McMahon got the idea for Jimmy Hart's megaphone from Wakamatsu having a megaphone in New Japan.
Yep.
So you can say Bruce Hart is directly responsible for the Jimmy Hart megaphone gimmick.
There you go. And then Megami Super.
Yes, Megami Super was the biggest, I guess, we hear them referred to as an eyeglass company, but I think they were more of a lens company that ran eyeglass stores too, right?
Yeah.
Like they're more of a, I don't think there's necessarily an American equivalent, right? It's kind of like if a Nikon or whatever had eyeglass stores, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, or,
it's more
know.
Like that than a. It's more. It's the lens company having stores as opposed to
Lens Crafters.
But Lens Crafters, I don't think is like a lens company. You know what I mean? Like a Nikon. What's the?
Yeah.
Like a. Like I don't. You know what I mean? It's not like a Crizal or whatever.
Bausch and Lomb having their own stores.
Kind of.
Yeah.
And they just had a ton of money, and the head of the the owner of the company or whatever decided to start a wrestling company, and that was SWS, and he lured people away, and...
He was also aligned with UWF, too, before.
Right, he was one of their backers, and then... And that's why, at least at first, he was backing Fujiwara Gumi.
Although that's right.
Although it lasted after he pulled out... One of the things I never understand about the whole SWS story is why they were backing so many promotions at first. Like, okay, I get SWS, I get Fujiwara Gumi because you want to keep the shoot style stuff separate.
Tokyo Pro.
But then, wait, they backed Tokyo Pro later?
Yeah.
I thought that was someone else.
I thought we talked about that on the show.
We did, but I thought it was someone else.
My
point is, though, they also backed Now, too, which was...
That's it, Now. Not Tokyo Pro, Now.
I always forget whose promotion that was, though.
That was Kendo Nagasaki.
Oh, no, Kendo Nagasaki. But so why are you backing this weird indie on top of the shoot style promotion and your major league traditional promotion?
Wrestling breeds strange bedfellows.
I've never heard an answer for that. That's one of wrestling's great mysteries. And yeah, so I think that's the basics of it. And you know, as we've talked about before, how the rep that most of the guys who went got was that during the in-between period, and then they didn't change, that they got bad habits and started just getting lazy and not training and eating a lot.
Yeah, I got fat. Fat and lazy.
Well, Fuyuki made the transformation before the switch actually happened.
Yeah, so...
Fuyuki changed fast.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you watch that tag where Misawa unmasks. That looks like, you know, 90s Fuyuki. That doesn't look like Samson Fuyuki of the Footloose.
No.
And that's what, after knowing his intention to jump for like a month?
Pretty much. Just didn't care. Crazy. All right, FMW, not too much going on, but Botswana Beast canceled his upcoming tour at FMW starting on May 19th, and he would be replaced by Bullman Downs, who works for Killer Brooks in Texas. Now, this is notable because Botswana Beast, not too long after this, would start up in All Japan as Kamala 2.
Clearly someone told him that Baba was interested.
Gotta be. And to go from the Beast to Bullman Downs, oof. What a drastic change of worker.
Yeah. Wait, why Bullman Downs of all people? Of all of the indie workers in Dallas at that time, working for the, you know, four or five different promotions.
I don't know, maybe, you know, FMW at this time period is kind of changing their styles. You know, they're not the full, like, martial arts.
Yeah, and Bullman Downs doesn't fit into either of them.
And they're starting to go into more of the hardcore stuff. I don't know, Japanese... And America Town going to Japan in the 90s is, you know, there's a lot of odd fits.
And you couldn't book Butch Blackheart?
I mean, All Japan. You look at some of those guys that went to All Japan in the 90s. You're like, huh?
Who are you thinking?
Oh, the guys in general. I mean,
well, the Undertakers.
That's one. Foley in All Japan was a weird fit.
Foley in All Japan teaming with Texas Terminator Haas of ICW Savolti fame.
Yeah, just some weird deals.
You know, a Foley in All Japan at that point is not a terrible fit, though.
He was using that style. I mean, he wasn't full force yet, but still. This is the time period where he's
teaming with Eddie. He would have been a better fit for FMW, but of the big two, he's certainly a better fit for All Japan than he is for New Japan.
I guess you could say that, yeah. But All Japan was changing; they weren't in the American style as much anymore. Right. That's the thing. So,
and he did have that good match with Kobashi, though.
Yeah, 80s All Japan, he would have been fine. Back to FMW, Ricky Fuji, who had worked in Western Canada as Fred Young, S-J-U-N-G, is coming back to Japan to work here. Now, the thing about Ricky Fuji was that he was a New Japan guy, a dojo guy, went to Canada and never came back. I think if I remember right, the story was he left the dojo. He just left. He didn't graduate. He just left.
A dojo runaway, like Chocobo Mukai.
Yes. And I guess he had the hookup with Tokyo Joe in Calgary, and that's what happened there. But
and that's why Ricky Fuji always had his Calgary jacket.
Yes, and Ricky Fuji became one of the quintessential workers of FMW throughout his existence.
Yes.
Very underrated guy, too.
I'd love to know more about your Dozier Runaways who became wrestlers.
Yes.
And also your guys like Ultimo Dragon who graduated but then did not get hired by New Japan.
And who knows what All Japan guys were like that, too.
Yeah, I mean, with all of the major promotions. But
yeah.
I think that's one of those things I don't think people realize. Ultimo Dragon's a New Japan Dojo guy.
Mm-hmm.
He went, and I believe he graduated, and then they didn't hire him because they thought he was too small.
Yep.
Now, where it gets a little confusing is sometimes you hear people refer to Liger as being similar because then, you know, then Ultimo goes to Mexico and blah, blah, blah. But with Liger, it was that he had decided when New Japan wouldn't take him because he was too small that he would go to Mexico and get trained, and then I don't know who he was trying to train with or whatever, but he was pretty much homeless or close, and someone at the UWA office sent word to New Japan, like, you've got to bring this guy in. Both for his own good and because he was dedicated.
And the rest is history. And the guy just worked in Ring of Honor for the last week. You know, so still going strong. So, yeah, a testament. But yeah, there's a lot of guys. Hisakatsu Oya is another guy that comes to mind. There's a lot of guys that Gato and Jado. There's a lot of guys.
Wait, was Oya All Japan or New Japan?
New Japan.
But now Gato and Jado, though. So I thought the Takeshi Progress or Gundan guy were not New Japan Dojo.
I think there's some gray area there.
Okay.
There's some gray area.
I thought they were trained by someone in Wally Yamaguchi's basement. I didn't think they were trained to.
But I think they had experience in New Japan Dojo.
Oh, so like while there was the New Japan affiliation, they started in the New Japan Dojo, and then when the Takeshi Kitano thing fell apart, they went off on their own.
I don't know the full story behind that, but I do know. I mean, there was something there.
I think we've talked about this before, but can you imagine the people who are listening and then wondering why the hell I just brought up Takeshi Kitano?
Well, one week we'll be talking about Takeshi Pro Wrestling, so it'll come up.
It'll come up.
All right. All Japan Women, they ran a show on May 13th at Korakuen, drawing 10 short of 2,000 fans, 1990, which is interesting. That's the year and the attendance. Which was headlined by a boxing match between Medusa Michelli and Aja Kong for the IWA ladies title that went to a draw. And then we have Manami Toyota retaining her WWWA title, beating Esco Mita. And Akira Hokuto and Shizuka Minami beat Yumika Hata, and Misuoko Nishiwaki to retain their WWWA tag titles.
Just give in to what Meltzer does and call it the 3WA title.
Medusa and Aja Kong in a boxing match.
I thought it was kickboxing. I'm guessing it said boxing at the time.
May have been. It was listed as boxing in the Observer. So.
Didn't that match play a big part in getting both of them over, though?
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember what the latest I've read on this is. That I know at the time people thought they were shoots, but
it was shoot boxing. That's what it was called.
Well, shoot boxing is kickboxing with takedowns.
Yes. But and there's clips of it on YouTube.
But what do you know as far as whether or not these were actual shoots, though?
Ah, no.
Oh, they weren't?
No.
Okay.
No, it was all work. Of course.
So what was the idea then of having everyone do kickboxing matches?
I don't know. I guess to just do something different. Hmm. And of course, Akira Hokuto's in the news this week because of her situation with her mastectomy, which is just, you know, taking a toll on the family financially, and they're in debt and trying to get as much work as he can to help pay the bills. It's a sad, sad situation.
I hadn't seen that. What's the healthcare situation in Japan then? Like, as far as insurance and whatever.
I don't know, but it's not good. I know I retweeted something about it on Sunday. So, yeah, it's she's completely bald. You know, she had to shave her head, and it's just not a good situation for the family. So keep them in your thoughts. Because, I mean, they got some young kids, and it's bad when you go through something like that. All right, as we continue on international, let's go to Mexico, into EMLL. The only thing we have this week, because we don't have anything from our great Lucha Libre Weekly stash that we've got, Angel Azteca.
Yeah, there's not much for 1990, unfortunately.
No, not much. Retained his NWA middleweight title over Io de Gladiador on May the 13th at Arena Pista Revolucion, which, of course, that's like that was the third of the Mexico City arenas. That's where that many had like your C team shows at. But fun little building. Angel Azteca, at this time period, hell of a talent. Oh, a guy who injuries basically wiped him out over the years. But man, he was good.
Anyone who wants to see what we're talking about with him, check if his matches with El Dandy are on YouTube, check those out.
And Io de Gladiador, for those who don't know, he was the original Talisman. He was part of La Ola Blanca with Dr. Wagner Jr. and Angel, and Grand Marcus Jr., excuse me, in the early 90s. And now he is one of the full-time trainers at MLL in their schools. So, yeah, he's still heavily involved in the business. And real name Arturo Beristan. So, yeah, he's been a key guy lately. Wasn't, I don't know, as a worker, he was okay. He was fine. For what we have of him, I think he's better as Talisman or Talisman. But what are your thoughts about him?
God, it's been a while since I've seen anything of him. Wait, I'm trying to remember. Wait, did he get replaced in the new Ola Blanca, though?
No, they were there.
Why did I think there was something? It was always him, Wagner Jr. and Marcus Jr.?
Yeah. Okay. And him and Mark, and even though he was the storyline blood relation to El Gladiador. That one is dad.
Well, same with Grand Marcus, right?
Yes, same thing. The only one that had the father was Dr. Wagner.
I feel like I've probably seen more Talisman than El Gladiador. Not a lot, though, now that I think about it, though. But, I mean, I always liked him when I saw him.
Yeah, he was good. So, lost one of his famous later matches was he lost his IWRG Intercontinental Middleweight title to a very young Magnum Tokyo in 1998. So,
oh, that's right. Okay. I remember that.
That's one of his famous final matches. But and on that note, we'll go to our break. And when we come back, we're going to go back to the United States. And we'll start off with Potpourri this time, where Grizzly Smith has started up a new independent group, and Ivan Pusky and his wife started a new independent group, and Sports Channel New York thinks wrestling can beat the NFL. We'll see after the break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back. And as always, after our break, we'll talk about our Amazon referral link, and that is tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon, where once you go to that link and put things in your shopping cart on Amazon through that link, we will get a percentage of every purchase you make, nothing extra, of course, from on your end, and helps go to our vast research that we do for these shows, give us material. It's helped us out a lot lately in getting a few things, and other people have been very generous in donating stuff. I know we talked about last week about the Lucha Libre weeklies and stuff like that. And just this week, we've had a couple of people come forward offering to send us different back issues of the Observer that we might not have. Again, if you have anything, get in touch with Bix or myself and let us know what you have. And, I mean, mainly we're just trying to fill the gaps. Of course, you know that, you know, we have the Torch. We have, you know, a large sum of the Observer in the 90s, basically. I mean, there's some missing gaps there. But
most, we have the vast majority of Matt Watch.
Yeah, and we're missing, of course, 99, which they're putting on the website now. But 99, 2000, 2002, other weeks mixed in there. There are gaps in the collection. So, again, if you have anything that you think that we might need, send it along. And hey, if you have any Aftermax that you're willing to part from back in the day, hell, we might be interested in using them. That could be good material for
you. No, we're not going to read the are we really going to read the August 1990 issue of
You never know what you might find
that
in there.
In February.
You never know what you might find in there. So yeah. So anything like that, let us know. And if you want to go PayPal, Bix, how do we do that now?
Yeah, if people want to donate stuff via if you want to donate via PayPal for helping us gather further research and stuff, my PayPal.me link is paypal.me/DavidBix. Just put in the comments that it's for Between the Sheets related activities.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we always, again, thank you for your support. I know I saw the Bartles and James commercial from the mid-late 80s, but yes, thank you for your support. All right, moving on to back to the United States and to Potpourri and Sports Channel New York. They're talking about doing a wrestling block this fall on Sunday afternoons to counter the NFL games on CBS and NBC. Bix, this is your area of the country. Of course, you got the Giants and the Jets in New York. So, in this time period, and even now, on Sunday, if both teams play on Sunday, one has to play at 1 o'clock and one has to play at 4:30. They both cannot play at the same time. So this is a block that would need to last for about 6 hours.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
And what's that?
That didn't happen.
It didn't happen. That's what I thought.
I don't even remember there being a daytime block at all. I remember them eventually running Sunday night is the block I remember.
Yeah.
Which had, I mean, in 1990 was the peak of it, though. So I think you had some combination of AWA All-Star Wrestling, USWA Challenge, Savoldi's ICW, I think Rob Russin's IWA, and maybe Herb Abrams' UWF too?
Sounds about right.
Trying to think if there was anything else, or I don't think UWF was necessarily part of it though. I don't know if I ever watched UWF outside of Sports Channel America, which is what I remember watching UWF on. But they had a good block going for a while. I mean, that was always a lot of fun to watch.
I was always jealous of my brother. He had a satellite dish where he picked up all that crap, and I never could see it unless I was at his house.
ICW did air on afternoons for years, though.
Like, I would go to his house, and I would watch ICW if I was there in the afternoon, watching Tony Atlas against Vic Steamboat. It seemed like it was airing every time I turned it on there.
Yeah, but ICW 1990 especially is a lot of fun to watch, because after a while, they just give up on showing new stuff and just show stuff from the previous 5 years to
Curly
celebrate
Mo.
The fifth anniversary of ICW.
And Curly Mo, of course.
Curly Mo wasn't around yet.
That's what I'm talking about, the era I was watching.
Oh, with Curly's Classic Corner?
Yeah, and Tony Rumble. Oof. All right, moving
You're
on.
You a Tony Rumble fan?
No.
He's better
not
than
back
Duke,
then.
Though.
Yeah.
What about
Not
Bob
good.
Dow? Did you like Bob Dow?
I really didn't have an opinion of Bob Dow.
What about Donna?
Donna? I remember Donna. Oh, me.
Wait, you do remember Donna, right? He turned out to be, what was it, Tony Rumble's stepdaughter was actually what it was?
Yeah. Grizzly Smith's five-star wrestler.
Let's go to Donna now on the ICW. What to the other? Jeez, Dow, I don't know. This is getting
Hi,
crazy.
I'm Donna, and I just stopped by to tell you to keep watching for me with the ICW Teen Report and keep sending your letters in. See you next week. Bye.
You really shouldn't have said Grizzly Smith right as I played the Donna clip.
Gee, you would not know where Donna was from that accent, I'm telling you.
I know. It's incredible. She should tell Missy Hyatt and Bonnie Blackstone where to find her voice coach.
Oh, man. All right,
it's Griffith's a WWF-worthy accent right there.
Yes. Stephanie did that accent on Monday night. Talk about when she did SAWFT. Swat. All right, Grizzly Smith's Five Star Wrestling had their first shows on May 12th in Jackson, Mississippi.
Maria Kanellis' favorite promotion, not Meniel.
She loves her five stars. Drawing only 300 fans, and later in the week had a show in Monroe, Louisiana. Monroe, drawing 200 fans with either these matches as your main matches. Junkyard Dog versus Brian Lee. Or Junkyard Dog and Mike George versus The Beast, Lou Fabiano and Brian Lee. And then your semifinal on those shows was Wendell Cooley and Sam Houston versus Johnny Mantell and Bob Orton Jr. Now, Grizzly, in an interview tape for the television, did admit that Sam Houston and Rockin' Robin were his son and daughter. It's funny here, JYD's working for Five Star, and then a week later, here he is with NWA. Kills that promotion dead. Because he was going to be the big star of the group.
Yeah. Those promotions that tried to start up were in the Mid-South territory. Like, there are a bunch of them within, like, the following 5 years. And none of them lasted long. And
was
none
it
of them
Heritage?
Sent.
Heritage Championship Wrestling,
was
that one of them? That was around this time period.
Is that the one with Mike Davis as the booker?
Yes.
The one that Downtown Bruno worked for?
Yes.
Okay, so there was Heritage. There was Five Star. There was Buck Robley tried NWF in 92.
Then you had Mid-South in 95.
The one that McFoley worked for?
The one that, yeah,
and
something
Baxter
like that.
And...
You had the one that had the Disco Inferno and Dick Murdoch.
No, that's Deep South.
Deep South, excuse me. And then you had Mid-South, yeah.
And then there was Mid, yeah, and then the Mid-South. I thought Deep South was in Georgia.
No, that was the Big South.
Oh, no, you're right. That was nope. Louisiana.
Yeah.
And Brandon Baxter worked there too, right?
I don't remember if he did. All I remember is Dick Murdoch and Disco Inferno as guys there. Because that's where Disco was before he went to WCW.
And Disco Inferno was god-awful.
Yes, he was terrible. But, ooh, again, this is the era where we're getting all these startups. You know, groups trying to get television, stuff like that.
South
and another,
Atlantic.
Yeah. Rob Russell's IWA, Herb Abrams, UWF, you know.
Global.
Global later on. And another one here. As Ivan Putski and his wife, Pat, held their first TV taping on May 11th in Houston. At Sam Houston Coliseum, drawing 1,000 fans for the WWA. Now, they taped a lot of matches. I'm just going to go over some of the key
did
names.
Any of these
here.
Air anywhere?
Yeah, they had television.
Oh, they did? Okay. I've never seen this.
G.I. Bro. Yes, this is Booker T as G.I. Bro, as a rookie. He beats Bobby Perez.
Is Super Collider on the card, too?
Yeah, Super Collider is on this card. Steven Dane and Russian
Wait,
Brute.
Do you know who Super Collider is?
Does that be Stevie Ray?
Yes.
Yeah. He beats Ken Johnson. Steven Dane and Russian Brute beat Frogman LeBlanc and Dusty Wolf.
What a tag team match that is.
The then Russian we got a Brute. And Steven Dane.
Let's just say Oxbaker did not have the best record in track record in training, guys.
Then we have the Night Stalker.
Another Oxbaker training.
In a handicap match over the Hog and Don Serrano. Ivan Putski worked this car, beating the Executioner, whoever that probably was. Scott Putski beat Tiger Conway Jr. We have a Curtis Hughes siding in a squash match. Paul Orndorff beat Tom Jones. Not the singer, the guy who played Mr. Ebony. The Fantastics, which would have been probably Bobby and Jackie Fulton, over Speedy Gonzalez, Andale, 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 and Wild Thang. Then we have Frankie the Thumper Lancaster over Speedy Gonzalez. We have Curtis Hughes and Night Stalker as a tag team. Wow, what a match this is. Steven Dane and Paul Orndorff beating Tyre Conway Jr. and Dusty Wolf.
That's probably the best match on the card, to be honest.
So, yeah, this was their first TV taping, and they did more.
Oh, the name is Wild Thang, not Wild Thing.
Wild Thang.
It's
yeah.
Spelled Wild Thang.
Yeah, Thang. Thang. Yeah.
Does that mean he thinged in the past tense?
I guess they were going for the Texas way of saying it. And in our last news of potpourri, Ricky Rice of Top Gun's fame beat Charlie Norris of WCW lawsuit fame to win the PWA heavyweight title on Eddie Sharkey's PWA show in Fridley, Minnesota on May 14th in front of 400 fans.
At Roper's, right?
Yeah. Also taking place in the show was a PWA junior heavyweight title match between Jerry Lynn and the Lightning Kid.
Who names a bar after a character played by Norman Fell?
Or John Saxon in Enter the Dragon, Mr. Whoopa.
By the way, you know the Ropers there's on Antenna TV.
Yes, it does. I have watched that show at times, and it was not good at all. Although Jeffrey Tambor was pretty entertaining in his role as the son-in-law or something like that.
Something like that. Yes.
Yeah, the Mr. Wolfa, Bruce Lee, Jerry Lynn and Lightning Kid. Jerry Lynn and Lightning Kid. This is where they got their first big break. Was working for Eddie Sharkey.
Yeah, and Sean Waltman sure was good at the beginning.
Yes, and Jerry Lynn wasn't that bad either.
No, but it's scary how good Sean Waltman was right away.
Yes, he was a natural, for sure.
More his psychology and his healing and all that than his moves that made it.
Yeah,
that was so impressive.
Yes. All right, now, and stuff I wish we had audio of, but we don't. Let's go to USWA. And on the May 12th WMC TV show, Jerry Lawler did a bit where he went to an old shack, which he said was Jimmy Valiant's mother's house. And he wanted to wish her a happy Mother's Day. But of course, there was no one home. So Lawler says she must be at the laundromat. And he had to go there. Lawler shows up and sees Jimmy Valiant's, quote, mother, unquote. So she and brings her presents from Jimmy. She opens up. She thought one was jewelry, but it was really soap on a rope. Then she gets these packets, which looked like Lipton cup of soup, but it was actually doll food packets. After this, they go back to the studio with Lawler and Valiant runs out attacking Lawler with a trash can. Then cuts a very serious promo about his mother, who was actually dead. Wow. Have you ever seen this, Bix? I've never seen this skit.
I don't think so.
At least I don't remember seeing it. I could have seen it 25 years ago, you know, or 26 years ago when it first aired. But I did not remember this at all. I would like to see the old shack they use for Jimmy Valiant's mother's house.
So is Jimmy Valiant's mother Jewish?
I don't know.
A little funky half Jew. Yeah. Well, no, if it's his mother, he would be fully Jew. Never mind.
Yeah. But Lipton cup of soup. Oh,
do they make that anymore?
Yes, they still make it. My mom buys it. Yes, they still make it. She buys it because she doesn't like a whole can sometimes to eat it. So she just, you know, buys a little cup of soup.
Is it better than Toshiaki Kawada's ramen?
I don't know. We need to ask Jose Fernandez about that one.
Yeah, we do.
But anyway, yeah, Valiant's here, and this is the first time that really people saw Valiant after he had lost a lot of that weight in this era. He looked skinny.
It's not as bad as it was later, but this is the beginning of it.
Yes, he did not look like the same dude. In an attempt to draw more fans, they lowered the ticket prices to $1 for kids under 17 and $2 for women. They also brought in a magician in a gorilla suit to perform for the kids. This magician appeared on the May 12 TV show and messed up his trick the first time before getting it right the second time, which was pulling a bra out of Dave Brown's tie. Now, also this Monday at the Coliseum, there will also be a singing competition between the Southern Rockers and Jerry Lawler, which should be interesting since Lawler has cut several records and Rex King is a really good singer. All right, Bix.
What?
This a magician in a gorilla suit pulling a bra out of Dave Brown's tie. And then Jerry Lawler singing against Rex King. I mean, that's an amazing visual on its own, but wow.
Pulling a bra out of nowhere. What was it? Robert Fuller in the gorilla suit?
I think it's just some guy. I mean, I guess a magician. I don't think it ever led to anything.
Maybe, was it Del Rios?
Well, you know what's funny is this is all happening a week before the snowman shows up. That's the week
they needed something to draw with.
That was the week after this, yes.
They Jesus Christ.
Well, all right. Here's the show at Mid-South Coliseum that Monday night. And you be the judge.
Look at those ticket prices, too. Kids for $1, women for $2. Kids under 17, too. Not kids under 12. Kids under 17.
Yes. Now, you be the judge on whether this should have drew or not. The Inhuman defeats T.D. Steele in your opener. USWA tag titles. The Uptown Posse. One of my all-time favorites. Short-lived tag teams. Brickhouse Brown and Sweet Daddy Falcone. Over the Southern Rockers. Chris Champion defeats Mike Awesome, Southern Heavyweight title. Bill Dundee, who was champion here but not champion in Texas, defeated John Tatum by DQ. Tony Anthony and John Tatum. John Tatum working twice because Jimmy Powell, who was the other dirty white boy, had quit and went back to Georgia, defeated Jeff Jarrett and Billy Travis. Should I say simply irresistible Jeff Jarrett and Hot Property Billy Travis at this time. And stretcher match for the unified heavyweight title. Jerry Lawler defeats Jimmy Valiant with Ronnie P. Gossett in a cage above the ring. So you see this lineup. What do you think?
And the main event's not a bad drawing match on paper, I guess.
But they're having to do something. They're trying to figure out why they're not drawing people to the show.
Have they instituted technical losses yet at this point in the year?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
Should I explain the technical
loss? Yes. Yes.
They change it to that every match must have a winner so that there was now no longer such a thing as a count out or disqualification. Anything that was not a pinfall or submission would be called a technical loss. And so titles would change hands on DQ and count out. And then if a match went to like a draw or whatever, then the first man off his feet was the loser and would lose by technical loss. Something like that. I think I have it mostly right.
Yes.
And it was strange.
Yes, it was. I mean, other promotions would do some crap like this, but yeah, it just didn't.
It didn't fit Memphis anyway.
No, it did not fit Memphis. All right, so this is the USWA of this era. That means we have Texas as part of this too, as they're co-owned by Jarrett. And the Sportatorium on May 11th, they drew 550 fans. Bix, what was the capacity on Sportatorium?
Sorry, I had myself muted. I think probably closer to 3,000 than the purported 5.
Yes. So, not good. All right. This is what they got to see. USWA tag title, Southern Uptown Posse over the Southern Rocker. Original.
Southern Posse in Dallas actually would have been interesting.
Yeah, I'd say so. All right. John Tatum, who was the Southern Heavyweight Champion here, defeated Bill Dundee.
Wouldn't they eventually explain that this was the Southwestern Heavyweight title?
Yes, eventually they changed it, yeah. He beat him after yanking Tessa's purse from her and using it on Dundee after Tessa had refused to give him the purse. Why was that? Because Dundee had kissed her on the mouth. And this match is on the WWE Network. So go check it out. It's really fun. Steve Austin defeated Chris Adams when Jeannie Clark sprayed Adams in the eye with some hairspray.
Is this the match where Mark Lawrence refers to the hairspray as that tear gas women carry so they don't get raped?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is Mark Lawrence's last show, too.
Yeah.
All right. Unified Heavyweight title, Jerry Lawler retains his belt over Jeff Gaylord in a heel versus heel match, although Gaylord was the babyface. Texas Heavyweight title, Kerry Von Erich retained his title, battling Matt Bourne to a double disqualification, and a match ended up in the parking lot, which was covered in mud because of the massive flooding recently. At one point during the brawl, Kerry hit USWA official John Brazil, and they announced on television the next morning that Kerry had been suspended, although Bourne wanted it lifted, and it got lifted. Bourne, this is about a babyface, although Bourne had basically turned heel, pretty much. And then your main event, Jeff Jarrett and Billy Travis defeated Tony Anthony and John Tatum by DQ. And after the match, Ronnie Gossett gave the babyfaces splashes.
If you've never seen Ronnie P. Gossett give babyfaces a splash, you are in for a treat.
You haven't lived, brother. I'll tell you that. You have not lived.
Is that match on one of the network things, too?
Yes. I think a lot of this whole card just about is on the network.
Is it on as episodes of Challenge, or is it on the Best of the USWA?
Don't know the top of my head.
Everyone remember that's in the global section.
Yes, in the global section. Yeah, everybody go watch that stuff anyway if you haven't watched. It's really fun. Really fun stuff.
But stop when you get up to 91.
I like the 91 USWA stuff.
Some of it's good, some of it's good, some of it's not. So a lot of it is, you know, empty sportatorium, grande.
Well, sure. I mean, a lot of this era is empty sportatorium.
No, but visibly empty.
Again, a lot of this area was visibly in this
auditorium. You don't see empty benches in 90.
You see some. You see them in 87.
Yeah, but you don't see them in 90. You see them in 87 and 91.
And Global 92 on ESPN Classic, which, oh my goodness gracious.
Yeah. Yes, Calvin Knapp versus Jobber.
Calvin Knapp versus Jobber, which a kind soul was able to get that for us, and we had that image on For Us and Only. In the,
actually, there it said Jobber versus Calvin Knapp.
Yeah, so the Jobber was higher
Jobber
regarded.
Was the A side of the match.
Which I read the story behind that. James Beard had said that what they were going by was the television crew was going by Gray Pearson, who's the owner's his format, and that's what he had on there, Calvin Knapp versus Jobber, because that's what he thought. I mean, that he was using the business term, so that's what they went with. All right, on the May 12th TV show, which was taped the Saturday morning at Sportatorium after the Friday night show, and was aired on KTVT. What, that night? It was the same day?
Yep, same day.
Yeah. There was supposed to be a birthday party for Kevin Von Erich, whose birthday was on May the 8th, but someone sabotaged the party, tearing up all the decorations. And Kevin vowed revenge and found out who did it, which I don't know if that ever was revealed, which I'm sure it probably was. Billy Travis would come out and led the crowd into singing happy birthday, but kept calling Kevin Calvin. Or maybe it's just Billy Travis, you know, his accent.
Calvin Von Erich versus Jobber.
I want to see. I'll try my best to find Billy Travis singing for Kevin Von Erich, but I couldn't find it anywhere on YouTube.
By the way, I'm not normally a fan of Kevin Von Erich's political tweets, but he actually had a funny one this week. Did you see the? Do you know the one I'm talking about?
No.
He tweeted that. Something about, like, the time I met Hillary Clinton with a photo of him spanking Sunshine or whoever.
Oh, that is funny. Oh, Kevin. And the funny part about this was Dave in The Observer was writing about how it was Kevin's 33rd birthday. And he's like, man, that makes me feel old. This was in 1990. Kevin's almost 60. Hi. Eric Embry has quit the promotion, mainly because he has had a hard time fitting in as one of the boys after being the booker for so long. Yeah, I can see where that would be a problem. The guys used to tell what to do. You can't tell what to do no more. And it's hard to go back to that old reality of what you once were.
Just being a mere pro wrestler.
Yeah. Just being one of the boys.
Not being able to... put piss on somebody over Kerry Von Erich with the claw.
Not be able to piss on somebody or something like that. Yeah. Picture like this. Craig Johnson, the new play-by-play announcer, I think he started that Friday night or he started that Saturday morning, one of the two, is said to be a cross between Hugo Savinovich and Vince McMahon, from what people told Dave. And he has no idea what that really meant.
What does that mean?
I don't know either. See, Dave hadn't, I guess, seen the show yet. So, across from Hugo Savinovich and Vince McMahon. That makes him one hell of an announcer, doesn't it?
Wonder what it would have been like if he called Triple Mania last year.
Not a fan of Hugo?
Well, that wasn't his fault. But...
Huh?
I said that wasn't his fault. I'm just...
I know, but are you not a fan of Hugo?
I like Hugo.
What about Vince?
He varies.
Yeah, but Vince was awesome once, though.
So. Yeah, no, for sure. I have to think whoever said that meant that negatively, though.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. So, somebody didn't like Craig Johnson. All right, there's talk of making the Saturday morning tape is free once again because the crowds went from 2,000... when they were free, to 150, 250 with the $2 charge. Part of the reason is that there is a homeless shelter blocks from the Sportatorium, and the people there who can't afford anything were using the tapings as free entertainment, which is why the crowds were so good for those shows. Thoughts?
This would only get worse in the global era.
In what?
The global era.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing like a promotion that's editing out all sorts of foreign object shots and always cutting to the same shot of a homeless man dancing in the crowd.
Oh, man. This is their version of WCW trying to hire models. Let's just raise the ticket prices.
Too tall.
We'll drive on the way.
Gotta keep the element out.
Yes. Oh, man. Well, let's go to the Pacific Northwest.
And then, of course, Global, though, we got to remember, was the promotion who worked into storyline because after Commissioner Joe Castellini was arrested for racketeering or whatever, he came back and was homeless and was doing odd jobs at the local homeless shelter where he was staying, down the block from the sportatorium.
Oh, man, those later days of Global. Oh, my goodness. Of course, it had to be an Italian.
Well, of course. He did that. What do you mean? He's doing a mob gimmick. What else is he going to
do? I know, but it's just hilarious.
He's not going to do a Yakuza gimmick.
Yeah. Pacific Northwest. A lot of things going on here. May 12th at the Portland Sports Arena. Larry Oliver beats Al Madrill. Then we have the Equalizer going to a no contest with Rip Oliver in 20 seconds when Billy Jack Haynes and Scott Norton interfered. Then we have the Grappler battling Scotty the Body to a double disqualification when Ginger, who's Scotty's girl, and Taylor Mae Medina, who is the heel girl valet, interfered, with the highlight being that Taylor's boo fell out of her bra for a split second.
Which funny story about that in
Observer. Funny story about that was the fact that people were upset they couldn't see it because it was that quick. I'm not lying. That was a report set today. All right, Northwest Tag Title Match. Ricky Santana and Curtis Thompson beat Beetlejuice and the Big Juicer. That's right. There was a guy named the Big Juicer. And no, we're not talking about a wide variety of names you can mention in the wrestling business.
No, we're just talking about J.W. Storm.
We're talking about J.W. Storm, who was a big juicer, legitimately. And a match was supposed to be the Equalizer and Moondog Moretti against the champions, but Moretti no-show. Now, after Santana and Thompson won the first fall, they returned for the second fall wearing Heart Foundation type gear, with Santana having his hair slit back into a ponytail like Bret Hart, but they would lose to the Juicers in that fall. And then Thompson would hit Beetlejuice with the belt to win the third fall, then announced after the match that they were now the U.S. males and that they were a heel act. So there you go, the birth of the U.S. male, Dix. Of course, Curtis Thompson carried that gimmick with him to other territories, but here it is.
Which is sadder, that he carried U.S. mail to other territories or that he carried Firebreaker Chip to other territories?
Well, the thing is about the U.S. mail and other territories, he would actually wear a postman's outfit.
Oh, yeah. That was always the weird thing about the WCW Patriots, too, that they have a guy doing a gimmick that fits. And they gave him a different. They gave him a different stripper gimmick. They gave him a different stripper public service gimmick.
Oh,
mailman's not aggressive enough.
Yeah, of course, especially the era where they were shooting up in post offices. Yeah. They're not aggressive at all.
We need him to be a firefighter.
WCW, everybody.
Because the best line ever on WCW television about Firebreaker Chip was Paulie Dangerously asking why Mr. and Mrs. Chip named their son Firebreaker.
Oh, man. And Ricky Santana, again, such an underrated guy. Good talent. But, man, he was in so many wild, funny gimmicks and stuff. The main event of the show. Listen to this main event, folks. This is 1990 now. Northwest Heavyweight title. Scott Norton beat Brian Adams to win the title after using Adams' kendo stick against him. They had claimed before the match that this was Norton's first match in wrestling, but after he won the title, Adams said that he was tricked because Norton had wrestled hundreds of matches. Which was true. I would think. I mean, he was in AWA.
Was AWA before this?
I think so. He was wasn't he Flapjack Norton in AWA?
Or was that later in 90?
It was sometime in 90. Hell, it could have been both. But, wow.
Scott and for Norton Tony and, Condello around this time, too.
Yeah, Scott and Norton and Brian Adams is your main event in 1990. Oof.
What was that Brian Lee match that we talked about earlier? I was going to mention that. I forgot. That sounded terrible.
From WCW?
No, from...
Oh, Five Star? JYD versus Brian Lee?
In 1990, yeah.
At least Brian Lee was working as a heel.
I'm sure you don't still want cut promos about being 6 feet 10 inches tall and 300 pounds.
Well, you got to know what you got. You know, you got to work with it, and you know what you got to do. Now, at one point during this show, the Grappler came out in a long coat singing while Equalizer, of course, we got to mention who Equalizer was. Equalizer, of course, was the famous Evad Dave Sullivan.
Bill Dannenhauer.
Bill Dannenhauer. And he was out here with Grappler. He was banging on a garbage can as drums before Scotty the Body ran out and pulled Grappler's coat open, revealing he was wearing nothing but a jock strap. What do you think about this one, Biggs?
I'm going to defer to... Oh, no, wait. Never mind, because I misheard and misread that for a second. I thought it was the opposite, so I was thinking... I was like, you're the expert on Raven's...
Wait a minute now.
So...
Now, but anyway, this was one of those rare times that we have a babyface Scotty the Body.
Yes.
And supposedly he was really good in that role, because basically he was still Scotty the Body, but turning it on the heels. Like his insults and shit.
That sounds good. Now, by the way, when you mentioned Ginger earlier, I guess this Veronica had left at this point.
Yeah, she was in Memphis with Rex King.
Do you remember what Veronica's greatest fame in wrestling was, though?
Humor me. I can't remember.
She's vivacious. She became Vivacious Veronica in WCW.
That's right. There you go. That's right. I forgot they were the same girl.
Yep. What was the deal, though? Like, I know there were the rumors. Did she happen to... Like, I know, there's always been the rumor that it was like, oh, she was the mistress of a WCW executive or a Turner executive who made them put her on TV. But that was always under the assumption that she was just this random person who had never worked in wrestling before.
Yeah.
I felt like. So my impression is that is bullshit.
I think it is too. And she, who knows, but
I don't know why you would go with Veronica before Jeannie Clark.
But the, I will say this, you know, the Portland in that era where she was there, the women were really hot. I mean, that's why they're trying to repeat it. With this whole deal with Ginger and Taylor Mae Medina, which Ginger had been around the territory for a long time. She came there with Scotty the year earlier, turned on him, went with the Southern Rockers, and here she is back with him again.
Who was the one that he almost did the wedding to, Ginger or Veronica?
Ginger. Okay. So, yeah, Portland, really fun stuff, really fun territory. At this time, I think it's all Lynn Denton. I don't know if Piper's got any input or not now because he's in WWF more often, but always fun stuff going on in Portland. And now let's close out with the World Wrestling Federation. And the big news here is that the Road Warriors are finally coming. After being rumored to come here for 6 years, as the NWA will be letting them out of their contracts with their final match taking place at the Capital Combat pay-per-view. The talk is that they won't earn anywhere close to what they're getting in the NWA, which is $2,000 per match, but they were sick and tired of how they were being treated in the NWA and decided now was the time to make the jump. Dave Meltzer said that truthfully, the NWA was tired of them as well, because along with Paul Ellering, they cost the promotion $5,100 per show. And then with the current gates, that is a ludicrous figure. They were offered $156,000 one year contract extension and felt that it was an insult. Felt that was an insult. Then Jim Hurt asked them if they would break up and feud with each other, the Pop Houses. Then after a short time, they would be brought back together, and they scoffed at that offer. So the writing was on the wall as their act had run its course, even with Ole Anderson, who created them, coming back in as the booker. All right, before we move on, how about that Jim Herd idea of splitting them up and feuding with each other? How do you think – I mean, we never got that. How do you think that would have worked? Really?
That well. No, I was saying that well. At that WCW in that point in time, that well.
Who would have been the heel? In that dynamic. I'm thinking Animal has to be the heel.
I think Animal's probably the better heel in that situation.
Because Hawk when
well,
he
Hawk is the one who sells.
Well, and Hawk's promos are, you know, babyface promos.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would have been, I mean, I would have been intrigued by that. Definitely. Although the thought of a singles match between them two, don't know about that one. But the Warriors have always had a standing offer to come here, but the holdup was that Vince McMahon would never guarantee a salary or promise to not change their name or gimmick. But the word at this time was that they wouldn't use the name Road Warriors or even wear face paint because of the Ultimate Warrior. They would be wearing similar outfits, though, and will go by the Legion of Doom. Their NWA contracts ended on December the 9th, and all along they were going to leave on that day, either to work as independents, go to Japan full-time, or finally the WWF. Now, before accepting the WWF offer, the Warriors made a proposal to Giant Baba to work 16 weeks per year and ask for $20,000 a week, but Baba turned them down. New Japan also heard of this and had no interest either. $20,000 a week? Of course Baba turned them down. But, all right, the main thing here is the whole face paint deal. Now, it came out a week later that, they were going to keep their face paint. But, yeah, there was a general thought around that week before that, you know, everything was finalized that, the Road Warriors were going to be forced to take their paint off. Which, how do you think that would have affected them in the WWF?
Oh, gee, I don't know. That would have been ended badly, I think.
And the thing is about that, why would you even do that? I mean, report this. Demolition's wearing face paint, too. You know? Of course, that's who they feuded with when they went there, but, I mean, that reasoning makes no sense to me. You can't wear face paint because Ultimate Warriors wears face paint. Well, fuck, you had Demolition there wearing face paint. Barbarian and Warlord had just been wearing face paint.
Imagine if they had long blonde hair.
I know. I mean, Warlord had just started doing his new gimmick this week. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's stupid, but we talked about it on this show before. The Road Warriors WWF run is highly disappointing.
Yes. I didn't realize.
I'm waiting on you to talk more about it.
I wonder if it would be less disappointing if they hadn't made even some of the minor changes they did, like if they didn't go so overboard with like the change in the outfits to the red and all that, and made them look too much like toys.
That's a good call. They did look a lot like real-life action figures or something like that, and no Paul Ellering.
At first, and then when they bring him in, Rocco.
Rocco! Yeah, I mean, they totally took, like, the toughness away from him, it seemed. The edginess.
Yeah, now, Paul Ellering coming back at first felt like, I mean, it was, I liked it.
It was a hot angle. And then they brought Rocco.
Can you imagine if they went all the way with Rocco and it ended up being that Backlund? Were they ever really going to do that, though? The various rumors that Backlund was going to turn out to be Rocco come to life.
I don't think that would ever happen. I mean, that would have been so damn silly. I don't think that would ever happen. I mean, I could be wrong, but
wouldn't it be great though?
It would have been a great television.
That would have redeemed. Would that have redeemed Rocco?
Yeah, it would have redeemed Rocco.
Can you imagine the team of Backlund and the Road Warrior and the Legion of Doom?
Oh my God!
With Backlund in the Rocco like denim. And his pro, and he'd be sitting on Ellering's lap during promos.
Oh God!
And Ellering's just cutting the promo for doing the Rocco voice, like LOD. Like, you know how they show him like at SummerSlam '92, whatever, and Rocco's chanting LOD, LOD. So he'd be cutting his promos for him.
There's all sorts of fantasy booking you can do.
And then Rocco would start escorting kids to the bathroom so that they're not left alone.
And making Darren Young's life great again. Oh, oh me. All right, they had TV tapings this week. We won't play the clips, of course, because they haven't aired. So when we do that week they aired, then we'll play the clips. But on May 14th in Madison, Wisconsin, Rick Rude, during his promo, announced that Rudamania was taking over, which made people think that he was being groomed for Hulk Hogan when Hogan returned, not the Ultimate Warrior. But that would change the next day as the big summer angle took place on the May 15th TV tapings in La Crosse, Wisconsin, as Hulk Hogan was a guest on the Brother Love show before Jimmy Hart came out to argue with Hogan until Earthquake jumped Hogan from behind, bashed him over the head with a steel chair. Earthquake then dropped on his chest three times with Hogan doing a stretcher job, and even Vince McMahon came down to check on him. This is Hogan's last appearance until SummerSlam, and the angle is he's planning on retiring from wrestling, but will be an all angle building up the Earthquake match. Tugboat's also in line for a major push as part of the angle, as he will be spearheading the drive to bring back Hogan, demanding fans write him. Dave Meltzer reported that Tugboat is getting his push courtesy of being recommended by Dusty Rhodes. Uncle Fred. That makes total sense, but yeah, I mean, whenever we do that week, you know, we'll, like I said, play the clips and stuff, but again, we have something else we talked about on this show. One of the lost rivalries of this time in WWF is Hogan Root. One that should have been happening, that would have been a natural deal, just never happened.
What was it that Hogan was afraid that Root would beat him up?
Hogan did not like, I mean, he thought Root was unstable. Think about that. Hulk Hogan thinks you're unstable. I mean, really?
Well, given the stories we've heard about Rude the last couple of years, maybe that's.
Yeah, you can see that there was reason for that, but
Hogan knows you inject things into the back, not the front.
Now there is this makes Earthquake. This is the big angle for John to make John Tenta a star.
I mean, this is the best Hogan angle post Randy Savage in the WWF.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And they did a really good job setting up that SummerSlam match. And when Hogan returns, humongous pop.
And Tugboat, though.
Yeah.
We talked about this before. Nobody knows what the hell happened.
Yeah, I love me some Fred Ottman, but yeah.
It must have been something really bad that we still don't know.
Well, he came back.
He came back, but how do we still not know? Like, that it's all, like, just the last second, it's like, oh, it's going to be the Big Boss Man instead.
All right, let's see. All right. Tugboat, I want to see how long he was out. Let's see here. This is great audio right here, folks. I know that. All right, Tugboat is still on television. In June.
Should I play the sad version of Real American?
he's in July. His team was him and Duggan was working Bravo and Earthquake on house show main events. Think about that as tag matches.
That's special.
Here he is working Buddy Rose on television in August.
Let's listen to this. Really.
Okay. The first Tugboat disappearance was at the TV tape, August the 15th.
Okay. Oh, so that's like what, 2 weeks before SummerSlam?
Yes. He works the. Well, you know when he comes back? The day after SummerSlam.
Okay, so whatever it was, they just specifically did not want him in that spot.
The day after SummerSlam. Yeah. He were Bob Bradley on TV. Let's see what else.
Doesn't this make you sad that Earthquake killed Hulk Hogan?
I know. He were to Conquistador. And he were to a dark match, was a costume video match with Hogan against Earthquake and Bravo. Also working at Superstars taping, Bix, Curtis Thompson.
I'm sadder about that than Earthquake killing Hogan.
And how about this match? Orient Express over George Scollin and Jim Powers. How about Marty Jannetty beating Black Bart?
1990 WWF is weird.
And Kerry Von Erich beating Barry O. And Rick Rude beating Glenn Roof.
Is Shane Douglas around?
And the Bushwhackers beating Pez Watley and Scott Colantonio.
And who?
Scott Colantonio.
Who is that?
I don't know. And then we have Nikolai Volkoff over Iron Mike Sharp in 1990. And Ross Hart working as Ross Lindsay.
Where?
Yeah.
At TV?
Yeah. How about Jimmy Snuka working Buddy Rose in a prime time?
A TV
match?
Job?
Yeah.
What show?
Superstars.
Against who?
DiBiase.
And where do you say this was? Utica?
Hershey. Yeah, how about Jimmy Snuka and Buddy Rose in a primetime match?
I actually remember that.
4 minutes. I know we're off track, but wow, that's a lot of stuff. Speaking of Hogan, let's get back to Hogan.
The coconut angle was a shoot, brother.
Hogan made an appearance on the Bugs Bunny 50th anniversary special on CBS over the week. And guess what we have, Bix?
The Bugs Bunny 50th anniversary special.
We have audio!
This is truly special. I should point out that when you hear Hogan and Okerlund talking, it's in front of the WrestleMania 6 backdrop, so it appears that this was shot at WrestleMania 6.
Yes.
I saw a guy do this in a toothpaste ad once. Ta-da!
Oh, oh, oh. Hulk Hogan, we've got a lot of pretty confident Bugs Bunny fans out there who are sure that Bugs will be the victor in your big upcoming match with him.
Bugs! I don't even have a match with Bugs!
Well, you mean you're not aware that Bugs Bunny, confident in his drawing power, has challenged you to a match?
Drawing power!
Bugs Bunny and Hulk Hogan in the same ring? Bugs, you don't know the first thing about wrestling!
And then they go to the Bugs,
That Buzz cartoon where he wrestles
Bunny
the big...
Bunny Hugged from 1951.
Yeah. All right. Gene Okerlund talking about Bugs Bunny drawing power in 1990 is amazing. Just amazing. Is there any way we can get Chris Harrington to do the numbers to see, compare Bugs' drawing power to other cartoon Star Wars drawing power? Bugs versus Mickey Mouse or something like that?
I don't know about cartoons. He's definitely better drawn than Sting.
Hey, Bugs wasn't sucking dick for $70,000. And that's for damn sure.
Who said Sting was? What?
I don't know. I'm just doing the Ole Anderson thing.
I know.
And audio, more audio I wish we did have. Demolition
you
is
know
currently.
What, though? What if Bugs Bunny was dressed up as a girl? But never mind.
Oh, man. All right. Demolition is currently being featured in a Pizza Hut commercial around the country.
I do not remember this.
I was looking long and hard for this one, too. I don't remember it either. So, that's an odd grouping. I wonder if it was all three of them or just Axe and Smash.
Had crushed.
Well, it could have been Brian Adams. He wasn't there yet.
Yeah, no, wait. We just talked about Brian Adams.
Just talked about Brian Adams. That's right. Wow.
Pizza? That's interesting.
Yeah. And in our final news story of the week.
I wonder if it's better than the Von Erich Pizza Inn commercials.
It might have been.
Did they have muffins right, at Pizza Hut back then?
They may have. All right, Bix, get ready.
Uh-oh.
The Torch reported that Terry Taylor has told the promotion that he is leaving when his contract is up in August and that he would not job on television. So basically, they're only using him on house shows. Now, Terry Taylor.
He was trying. He felt like he needed to go to a promotion with a better record on race relations.
In 1990, it's telling a promotion he's not jobbing on television. And they let him, and they said, okay, we just won't book you on television.
Wait, he's sure acting like the cock of the walk.
Oh, my goodness. Let's see here. All right, let's do a Terry Taylor search.
What are you looking for?
nothing that would be incriminating. His last appearance would be June the 16th in Moncton, New Brunswick, jobbing to Akeem.
Gee, that doesn't sound like a message at all.
he's working Dino Bravo. He's jobbing the Dino Bravo on May 25th in Albuquerque. Anaheim, he's jobbing
the
Bravo.
About their people and their drug crime? Those people and their drug crime. Damn it,
he's screwed
it up.
He beat Bob Bradley in Youngstown on May 20th.
Those people with their cat-like agility.
Yeah, he's jobbing the Dino Bravo in our week. All right, you want to know the big house show of the week is in the WWF that we're doing?
Sure.
Can you guess the building it's in?
How am I going to just guess the building?
This is a natural for you. You should be able to say this immediately.
Why?
Because you have experience in this building.
NASA Coliseum?
Yes.
Okay, but I wasn't at this.
On May 11th, 1990, in front of 8,800 fans.
My first house show was until the following February.
And at NASA Coliseum, they got this card.
How many fans?
8,800.
A little more than half a house.
Al Perez beats Jim Brunzel. Coco Beware beats Black Bart. Demolition and the Hart Foundation go to a double disqualification in a WWF tag title match.
Is that a babyface match technically at that point?
Yes, it is. Hmm. The Warlord defeated Tito Santana. Brutus the Barber Beefcake defeated the Genius. Paul Roma defeated Frenchie Martin. Sensational Sherry pins Sapphire. And the American Dream Dusty Rhodes pinned Randy Savage after hitting him with Sherry's purse. They ran Chicago.
That would draw half a house.
They drew Chicago the next day. Well, they ran Chicago the next day, only drew 4,900 fans. Hmm. With Akeem versus Jim Powers, Barbarian over Jimmy Snuka, Hillbilly Jim over Bob Bradley, Hercules over Haku by countout, Demolition of the Hearts and the double disqualification, Jake over Bad News, and Dusty Rhodes and Sapphire over Savage and Sherry. They ran three crews that day.
Well, what was the crew doing?
Listen, I guess there wasn't a C crew because they're running Baltimore, Cedar Rapids, and Chicago.
So it was the Chicago crew was in Cedar Rapids.
No. The Cedar Rapids crew was Baltimore. Let's do Baltimore first. Baltimore only has two matches listed: Big Boss Man against Ted DiBiase and Jim Duggan against Earthquake.
That sounds like easily the winner for the day.
Yeah, but looking at the way the thing is placed, that's probably the C show. Because here's your Cedar Rapids lineup. It's main event by Ultimate Warrior Mr. Perfect for the world title. That's not a C show main event. But you look at the rest of the matches, though. Pez Wiley against Paul Diamond. Tugboat versus the Brooklyn Brawler. Ronnie Garvin versus Rick Martel, which sounds like a hell of a match. The Rockers against the Orient Express. And Brutus Beefcake versus the Genius.
That's fine.
So that's your WWF house show scene for this week in 1990. And I'm looking at those TV tapings to see what kind of interesting matches are on there. Scott Colton gets beat by Akeem, Vix.
Yeah, that's a different Scott Colton.
I know. I just love saying that name.
Tom, did they have a Phil Brooks and a Chris Guy too?
No. Tom Stone's working there. Tony Burton.
Rocky Stone.
Yeah. Tony Burton's jobbing to Jake Roberts. Frankie DeFalco.
Wait, Tom Burton?
Same guy, yeah.
No, Tony
Burton's different.
Wait, you just said they're
the... No, that Tony Burton's, if I'm not mistaken, Tony Burton was the guy in Memphis that was part of the Fire and Flame angle.
Yes, that guy. Okay.
Yes. So, that's your house show. I'm going to see what the TV is for that week. Okay, Jimmy Snuka over Paul Diamond. Genius over Dale Wolf. Oh, the Intercontinental Championship Tournament was going on this week, Bix. Roddy Piper and Rip Martello in double DQ in the quarterfinals.
Oh, God. The finishes in that tournament. That one, I believe, was Martel tried to use the arrogance can and Piper grabbed a chair to block the spray and they both
DQ'd. Yes. Then Demolition beats the Black Knight and Buddy Rose. Coco Beware of a Randy Neverman. And the Warlord over the Warlord over Sonny Blaze. That was Wrestling Challenge. Superstars, their Intercontinental Tournament match was Dino Bravo and Brutus Beefcake to a double countout. Also on their
That
tape,
sounds like a classic.
Yeah, the Bushwhackers beats Buddy Rose and Elmer Johnson. The Barbarian beats Jim Gorman. The Orient Express defeated Louis Spicoli and Mark Young. Earthquake pinned Jerry Monty. And Tugboat beat the Brooklyn Brawler.
By the way, all these job guys with the weird names, that's going to be over soon since Chuck Austin's about to happen.
Is this what?
Charles Austin.
Yes.
Yeah, the rocker driver. That's about to
happen. Yes.
And that's mostly the end of these guys.
Yep. So
Scott Colton. not for 15, 16, 17 years, whatever it is.
Yeah. Alright. Well, on that note, we'll end the show this evening. And Bix, we had the plug.
I don't know, we did that earlier.
Other than that.
This week on 605, the Super Podcast at 605pod.com, we've got part two of our chat with John Arezzi on topics including the WWF scandal coverage back in the day that he was involved with, including getting a death threat the day of the Donahue show. Also talks about the unfortunate events that was him bringing Vince Russo into the wrestling business, among other things, promoting foreign tours, all sorts of good stuff there with John Arezzi, plus me and Brian talk about wrestling families a lot. Long discussion on that. There's still people we left out, although we covered a lot of ground. I know, who was it? Dylan mentioned, we didn't mention the Cormiers. Who else was it? I'm trying to remember. But we cover a lot of ground on there, so that's on there. We review Love Struck, the documentary about Sue Shooter, of Confessions of a Ring Rat fame, and lots of other stuff, and that is this week on 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com. What else? We also talk about some world-class announcers, as well as Glenn Goza and his wrestling song.
Yeah, which is so hilarious, wrestling. Oh, I mean, Glenn Goza. Oof, man.
R-A-S-S-L-N, that's wrestling.
Wrestling.
You know what my favorite part is, though, right?
What's that?
Andre the Giant must be 7'9".
Oh, yeah. I tell you, y'all come up with some really funny stuff y'all find for that show. I tell you, it's always entertaining. Always.
Speaking of podcasts from us.
That's right. Exile on Bad Street is here. The latest episode, part three, dropped on Sunday. Of course, Bix, of course, is the editor of the show. I'll always thank him for doing that for me. Bo James was the guest, just me and Bo this time, talking about July 1987 through mid-May 1988, because we went so long that I decided, I said I had to cut this off. I tried to find a perfect spot to cut it off at, and that was the right one. And it was so much good stuff on this show. I mean, it's one of my favorite shows we've ever done. It's all the great stories on there. The origin of the Mink Coat Battle Royal and what they did to keep the Mink Coat in the family is some of the best stuff you hear. Story about...
Why did they get a real Mink Coat?
You got to listen to the show. I know you have. I know you've been busy doing other things, but you got to listen to the show to get the story. You got to listen to it. I can't give it out over the air.
Is the person who ended up with the coat, though, a blonde woman who may or may not have been married to Robert Fuller?
Not necessarily, no. It depended on the town. As I said, you got to listen to the show to get the story.
Okay.
All right. The story of Beulah, the famous grandmother, if you watch Smoky Mountain Wrestling or USA Wrestling from any show from Knoxville in that era, even WCW, there was an old woman that sat in the front row, wore glasses, gray hair, who was very involved. And Bo tells the backstory on her.
She's the one who tries to go after Hogan on that Nitro, right?
Yeah, she tries to go after Hogan on Nitro. That's right. I've
seen the gifts of that. That's her.
Yes. So you get the story of Beulah, you get the story of the split, the promotional split, what happened there, which is amazing audio. You get the, you know, all kinds of great info from Bo. Bo is fantastic to tell stories on this show. The story of why the Rockers got fired from Continental, which is amazing. There's all kinds of stuff that's in that show. So everybody go check that out. And the next one, hopefully we'll try to get a one up quicker the next time. So, won't be as long of a wait. Next Trina Sheets is next week, next Monday. And we are covering 1991 as Super Brawl 1 takes place that week. So Ric Flair and Tatsumi Fujinami in Jacksonville, Florida.
I thought it was St. Petersburg.
St. Petersburg, excuse me. I had Jacksonville on my mind for that shitty clash that I was talking about earlier in the show.
Do we have a guest in mind for this episode?
We do not have a guest in mind yet, but we have that going on. A couple other things going on.
We should try to find someone who was there, because that was like the last of the WCW Deadhead shows, wasn't it?
Yeah, the fan convention was that week, so we'll try to figure that out. We'll hopefully have a good guest on that show that week. So, and other things going on, WWF stuff going on behind the scenes, and yeah, this should be a fun show. All right. On that note, let's thank Bix for being my co-host as usual and being the man that makes this show happen.
Twitter though, we didn't plug our Twitters.
Yeah, Twitter at David Bix at Chris Zellner, KRISCELLNER. So go check us out there.
K-R-I-S-E-L-L-N-E-R, that's Chris Zellner.
Yes, yes.
K-R-I-S-E-L-L-N-E-R, that's Chris Zellner.
Yes, right. So on that note.
Robert Fuller's must be 70. Sorry.
Robert Fuller's dick must be 70 inches long. On that note, we'll be back next week. Thank you for listening. So long from the Peach State of Georgia.
I'm the candy man. Ooh. Who can take a sunrise? Sprinkle it with you. Cover it with chocolate and a miracle or two. The candy man.
The candy man.
Ooh, the candy man can.
The candy man can.
The candy man can, cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
Makes the world taste good.
Who can take a rainbow?
Who can take a rainbow?
Wrap it in a sigh.
Wrap it in a sigh.
Soak it in the sun and make a groovy lemon pie. The candy man.
The candy man.
The candy man can.
The candy man can.
The candy man can, cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
Makes the world taste good.
Wishes.